next half hour, remembering the life and career of filmmaker Paul Morrissey, best known for his avant-garde collaborations with Andy Warhol. He has died at the age of 86. We'll also get a review of Netflix's The Diplomat. Second season begins tonight. Eric Deggans has that for us. Lots more All Things Considered still to come. Stick around.
Support for KPR comes from the Raven Bookstore, hosting local memoirist Louise Krug as she shares her book, How to Explain, November 7th at 7 p.m. More at ravenbookstore.com/events.
Not to be like the stores that trot out the Christmas candy before the Halloween candy has been put away, but want to remind you that we still have tickets available for KPR's Big Band Christmas. This often sells out. Saturday night, December 14th at Liberty Hall in Lawrence. Celebrate with the Kansas City Jazz Orchestra and special guests. A whole night of Kansas City jazz and holiday songs. Tickets while they last, which probably won't be long, at Liberty Hall and Ticketmaster.com. You can find out more at our website, KansasPublicRadio.org. The time is 4:20.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is now playing only in theaters. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. I was out to dinner this past week, big group, when someone at our table asked for two glasses of wine. Now, I am not one to judge, but I do ask questions for a living, and her response to me was, "I am so stressed about this election." She's not alone.
Welcome back to CBS Saturday Morning. We begin this half hour with anxiety over the coming presidential election.
It seems like no matter where you go these days, you can't avoid it. You're flipping channels, ads.
Yes, some doctors are reporting a growing number of people with election-related sleep issues.
Well, one of those doctors is Lucy McBride, doctor of internal medicine with a private practice here in D.C., also a prolific podcast host and newsletter author, and she has just written about managing our election anxiety. Lucy McBride, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So the headline here seems to be that everyone is stressed out, and I will cite data. This is a new report from the American Psychological Association that finds almost three-quarters of adults, 7 out of 10 American adults, say the future of the nation is a significant source of stress in their lives. Does that square with what you are hearing from patients?
Absolutely. I think if you're watching the news, if you're paying attention, frankly, if you're breathing air, you are noticing a certain degree of anxiety in most people. Yeah. And I'm seeing it in my office. I'm seeing it in my patients. I can see it in their faces. I see it in their blood pressure readings. And I hear it based on the behaviors they're using to cope. Patients report having a gravitational pull to the Halloween candy and to wine and to other self-soothing behaviors that they really know they shouldn't do but can't help.
Some of the guidance that you counsel is stuff that's not hugely surprising, but I found it so reassuring just to be reminded of it. Things like take a walk, book a yoga class. What else?
This is the week to pull out the business card of the therapist that has been sitting in the bottom of your purse for a couple months. This is the week to book that yoga class. It's also the week to prioritize rest and to prioritize calm and doing things that are non-political, watching a movie about cats or puppies or something benign.
I mean, you also counsel something which I am professionally obligated to object to, but you say we should be taking breaks from the news.
Yes, we are not wired to take in all of this information, to interpret all this information. It's important to take breaks. You can stay informed and still dose yourself with enough news to keep you informed, but not to agitate you, to keep you up at night.
Your last piece of advice is, it feels more like advice to us as citizens than advice as a doctor to patients. It's to go out and vote. Is there a health benefit to this, or are you just asking us to fulfill our civic duty?
if you think about anxiety as the absence of control, right? Anxiety hates the absence of control. The way you can exert some control over our election is to vote, to talk to your friends, to talk to your neighbors, join a phone bank, to exercise your independence and your voice is one way to quell anxiety and to feel like you've made a difference.
Meanwhile, have you eaten all of the Halloween candy?
Oh my gosh, the Halloween candy is just disappearing piece by piece. There are wrappers all over the kitchen counter. So I'm hoping we have some left for the trick-or-treaters tonight.
Okay. I will fight you for the last mini Snickers. Lucy McBride, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Let me ask you, is there anything scarier than an evil Santa Claus?
He's scaring my kid.
Yeah, he's scaring me too.
Hey, Santa's handing out presents!
Yeah! Or how about Satan?
It's the mark of the devil.
Or even aging?
Have you ever dreamt of a better version of yourself? Younger, more beautiful.
I certainly have. These are all horror movies that came out this year. And yes, my friends, it is that time of year again when I scare myself on purpose by talking to Rebecca McKendry. She's a director and critic of horror movies, and she joins us now to round up her favorites of the year. Hello, hello, Rebecca.
Hello. It is awesome to be back doing this again, talking about my favorite subject.
We love it when you stop by, All Things Considered. So just before we get into how things are changing, just what were your favorite horror movies that you have seen this year?
I love to leave the theater saying I have never seen anything like that. If I'm still processing it 12 hours later, that was a good movie in my mind. So The Substance is definitely up there. It's about an aerobics instructor who is getting really concerned about her career because she's aging, and she is presented with this drug that will supposedly allow her to live as a younger person so she can continue with her career.
That's amazing. Who wouldn't want that?
Sounds great. See the movie. Doesn't turn out that way.
Ah!
There's been a slight misuse of the substance.
It's hyper gory. It's body horror. It's weird. It's putting major actresses into kind of these weird, uncomfortable positions. But seeing it with a crowd in a theater, everyone was howling.
By that, you mean laughing. Not like howling like werewolves.
I do kind of mean howling like werewolves.
What?
Like in shock. Like, oh my gosh, I can't believe what I'm watching. Like just gasps. And then I also have to give a really big shout out to Abigail, which I love. This was a bigger film about a ballerina vampire.
Okay. How do we kill a vampire? What are we talking about? Like an Anne Rice or a True Blood, you know, Twilight?
Just kind of this like oddball idea out of left field, but it worked.
Every time that we have you on the show, Rebecca, you tell us about some unifying aspect that defined each year. What is this year's biggest horror trend? Like any themes that you saw repeated?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So the themes, I have seen a lot of franchises, IPs, reboots, sequels. The second trend that I'm seeing is this concept of surreal and absurdist, that not everything in the movie has to be explained, nor does it have to make sense. And I love it because it lets you just kind of exist in the horror and you leave with questions. The last trend that I'm really seeing is hyperviolence. Wow. And I am so excited to see this come back. This is something that I know.
A quote we usually don't hear guests on NPR say, but go on, Rebecca McKendry.
So I think that the reason behind this is always that for certain people, it's cathartic. I can go into a film like The Substance that is hyper, hyper gory, and somehow I can walk out of that and say, I feel better.
You know, when you were first saying that you were so excited to see gore come back, my first thought is, man, you are a sicko, Rebecca. But now that you're explaining it, you're actually quite mentally healthy. You're dealing
with it.
Thank you.
I think so. I always think of it, I use the phrase, taste death, live life. Because I think that, you know, we each kind of have the thing that we do to kind of make ourselves feel how alive we are, whether you are skydiving or getting a tattoo or riding roller coasters. And for a lot of us, we find that kind of refreshing extreme, like, oh my gosh, okay, I feel more alive from watching extreme horror films. And at the end of the day, I consider it to be incredibly healthy because I walk out of them going, okay, you know what? I was feeling bad. Now I feel great. I'm going to go get a cup of coffee and thank myself for being alive. So yeah.
That is Rebecca McKendry, horror director and film critic. Thank you so much once again for being here, and happy Halloween, Rebecca.
Happy Halloween. Thank you so much for having me.
This is NPR News.
The English rock band The Cure broke into the pop music scene in the 1980s. Later, they took a 16-year break.
I sort of thought I'd written everything I had to write, but as it turns out, I haven't.
The return of The Cure, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning, beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR stations for Morning Edition. Hear that interview with The Cure. I want to go back in time and tell 17-year-old me listening to Disintegration that The Cure were going to be on Morning Edition. Okay. Jay Schaefer will be your local host. Clear skies in the forecast tonight. Lows in the upper 30s. Tomorrow, sunshine with a high in the lower 60s. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy through the evening. But we do have a 30% chance of showers after midnight. Lows tomorrow night in the mid-40s. It's 4:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A huge portion of Nevada voters don't belong to any major party,
which makes election results very hard to predict in that state.
There is a large number of very young voters who are registered nonpartisan, who feel disengaged and alienated from the political parties.
No news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. 5 days to go before Election Day, and city officials in Detroit are preparing for their vote count to be challenged once again. From Detroit Public Radio, Russ McNamara says city officials are using history as their guide.
Since the 2020 election, Detroit has been at the center of baseless claims of voter fraud by Donald Trump. 4 years ago, his campaign filed numerous lawsuits that were thrown out. City Clerk Janice Winfrey anticipates there will be more challenges after Tuesday's election.
Why do they continuously do that? In my opinion, I think that they feel that they can bully us and get away with it.
Detroit Election Administrator Daniel Baxter was more direct.
It's because we're a black city.
Winfrey says the goal now is to eliminate any appearance of impropriety by releasing results faster after officials improved the processing of absentee ballots and added early in-person voting. For NPR News, I'm Russ McNamara in Detroit.
In the Middle East, Hezbollah has a new leader. He replaces Hassan Nasrallah, who was killed by a massive Israeli airstrike in Lebanon last month. NPR's Arzu Rezvani has more.
Naeem Qassem was never really meant to lead Hezbollah, but Israel has killed so much of the group's top brass in recent weeks that he was pretty much the last man standing. The 70-year-old cleric, who was Nasrallah's longtime deputy, offers a steady and familiar hand at a time of uncertainty. In his first televised speech as Hezbollah's new leader, Qassem vowed to keep fighting Israel. But his decades of political experience suggest there is also a way out of this war with him at the helm. Time is not on Qassem's side. Soon after his appointment was announced, Israel's defense minister, Yoav Gallant, weighed in with a not-so-subtle threat, saying on Twitter that it would be a, quote, temporary appointment that wouldn't last long. Arzu Rezvani, NPR News, Beirut.
Fewer people filed for unemployment benefits last week. This is NPR.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. Commissioners in Wyandotte County unanimously approved a resolution yesterday to promote expanding language access in local elections. Advocacy groups have urged the Kansas Secretary of State and the County Election Commissioner to provide voting information, ballots, and language assistance in Spanish. Micah Kubik, Executive Director of the Kansas ACLU, says language assistance would improve representation in all of the state's largest counties.
It would be a good thing for our democracy, for our community, if election-related information were available in the languages that folks here speak.
In a statement, the Kansas Secretary of State's office said it provided Spanish language election materials in other counties where federal law requires it. A literacy program at the only women's prison in Kansas is helping incarcerated mothers and grandmothers connect with their young family members. The program, operated by Fort Hays State University, helps some of the women at the Topeka Correctional Facility boost their reading abilities. It also gives them confidence to read aloud to their children and grandchildren when they visit or provide recordings for their loved ones. Sarah Broman Miller is an education professor at the university. She says the program allows women to bond with their children.
This one woman said that her daughter listened to that recording every night, and that was just her way of being tucked in by her mom.
Prison officials say the program helps with inmates' mental health and prepares them for re-entry to public life. As trick-or-treaters get their costumes ready, scientists are working to save a spooky native bug whose numbers have plummeted. The American burying beetle takes animal carcasses underground to feed its young. And it used to be in 35 states, but it's now just in a handful, including Kansas. Oklahoma State University entomology professor Wyatt Hoback has studied this beetle for 26 years. He says they're a conservation challenge.
They're wide-ranging, and they need carcasses. So it's really hard to manage specifically for them.
Hoback says the good news is that protecting burying beetle habitat also protects a lot of other plants and animals in the Midwest and Great Plains. Clear skies tonight with a low in the upper 30s. It's 57 degrees in Lawrence and it's 435.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from your part-time controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations meet their food needs from online ordering to simplified expense reporting with a nationwide network of restaurants all on one platform. Learn more at easycater.com. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Nevada is about as purple as a swing state can get. 4 in 10 registered voters there are not affiliated with either major political party. Nonpartisan voters are the largest single group in the state. And as NPR's Jung Yoon Han reports, it's unclear what curveball those nonpartisan voters will throw.
Julian Herrera knows who he's voting for, and it's Donald Trump. He thinks Trump would handle the economy better than Vice President Harris would.
It's been much worse with Joe Biden, and I just don't understand what would be different since she's already been the VP for 3.5 years.
Herrera, who's 22, voted for Trump in 2020 as well. The only difference is that he has since unregistered himself from the Republican Party.
The people that are actually a part of that party, the everyday person that is, you know, that extreme white right wing, that's just way too much. Like, oh my God, I hate liberals, I hate Democrats and all that. That's kind of what pushes me away from that.
The rise in nonpartisan voters is partly because in 2020, Nevada decided to automatically register new voters who do any sort of business at the DMV, like getting a driver's license, as nonpartisan. They can manually register for a political party later. But Sandra Cosgrove, a historian at the College of Southern Nevada, says that's only part of the picture.
There's probably a lot of voters that just didn't feel like re-registering, but there is a large number of very young voters who are registered nonpartisan who feel really disengaged and alienated from the political parties.
The jury's still out over which kind of nonpartisan outnumbers the other, and that makes Nevada one of the most unpredictable swing states. There are other reasons why the state is a curveball. It's using an all-male voting system for the first time. There's a ballot measure that would enshrine abortion rights, which Democrats hope will turn out voters. And Nevada, which used to vote reliably for Democrats, toppled its sitting Democratic governor in the 2022 midterms. That's where nonpartisan voters come in.
They're going to play a major role.
which is why we've, you know, built in an on-the-ground team.
That's Ty Sims, communications director for the Nevada Democrats. They've put nearly half of their offices in rural communities in order to court voters they don't always reach.
Most of these people we see as Democrats maybe just being registered as those nonpartisans or as those independents.
But Republican pollster Bob Ward, who conducts polling on Nevada for AARP, has a different view on these unaffiliated voters.
They are likely to be either disillusioned Republicans or Trump fans. These are not large margins. I don't mean to say that all of these people are that way, but he has the advantage.
Haley Dobbins is the communications director for Arizona and Nevada for the Trump campaign.
They trust President Trump on issues like the economy, on issues like immigration, on tackling the housing affordability crisis. And so those are the things that we feel like really turn out a lot of voters this election.
But 54-year-old nonpartisan Vance Acevedo lives in Las Vegas doesn't buy that argument.
He's had a concept of a plan for health care. Why didn't he implement it for 4 years? He had a concept of this immigration wall. Where is it? Mexico's going to pay for it. Did they? No.
But what Acevedo has found most disturbing is Trump's rhetoric, including that he wants to have generals like the ones Hitler had.
And I think there would be less support for Trump if people actually thought maybe he was going to do what he's saying he's going to do.
So imagine Acevedo's surprise when his partner, a fellow nonpartisan, told him he already voted for Trump.
Which is a radical reversal of his prior positions.
Acevedo, an ex-Republican, voted for Trump in 2016, while his partner voted for Hillary Clinton. Then they both voted for Biden in 2020. This time around, the couple still respects each other's decision and even joke about their votes.
We have to cancel each other out, I guess.
But that's not stopping Acevedo from volunteering for Democrats. Jeng Yunhan, NPR News.
A fiercely independent filmmaker, best known for working with Andy Warhol, died this week. Paul Morrissey was 86 years old. NPR's Netta Ulibi has this remembrance.
Andy Warhol was not a super famous artist when he met a skinny, intense film nerd in 1965. Paul Morrissey lived in an underground movie theater he ran in the East Village. He became Warhol's business manager and briefly managed the band The Velvet Underground, even though he hated rock and roll. One of his first films with Warhol just showed the group rehearsing. Before meeting Morrissey, Warhol made movies, but they were static, like a famous film that's just a single 8-hour-long shot of the Empire State Building. Morrissey added cuts, characters, life.
Hey, you!
Like the movie Chelsea Girls, their first art house hit from 1966. It's an improvised, 3-hour-long peek into the bohemian squalor of New York's Hotel Chelsea.
You, come in here.
What do you want?
Your heart.
My heart. I haven't got a heart.
Yes, you do.
The movie is not always easy to watch. Some of the actors are tripping and naked. There's S&M, violence, and a vaporous line between what's real and what's faked. Andy Warhol and Paul Morrissey made more than a dozen avant-garde movies over a decade. Warhol paid, Morrissey directed. They were extremely low-budget and provocative.
Go ahead, take your clothes off, man. Hurry up.
Like the one from 1968 called Flesh, about a hunky bisexual male hustler. In another scene, his girlfriend asks him, while in bed, for $200.
For what?
For my girlfriend's abortion.
$200?
Yeah.
Why do I have to give you $200 for your girlfriend's abortion?
Because you have the money and I don't.
The director was raised Roman Catholic, like Warhol. But Morrissey identified throughout his life as a deeply conservative Christian. A contrarian, he avoided drugs and sex even in the decadent swirl of Warhol's milieu. His movie's sex scenes were controversial, but not sexy. His actors are often wasted or uncomfortable, the opposite of the Hollywood sex scenes Morrissey despised.
It's just the stupidest thing in the world. People huff and puff and heavy breathe and go into clinches and roll around on mattresses with the clothes off. It's ridiculous.
Morrissey liked to insist he was pro-censorship, even though his movies were often banned. And he often cast transgender women in female roles because he genuinely liked their performances. He told Terry Gross in a 1988 interview on WHYY's Fresh Air that he hated professional actors, who he found pretentious.
And they're artificial, they're mannered, they're phony, and they're boring.
How did you cast people for your early movies?
If they were not boring.
Paul Morrissey's films, directed under Andy Warhol's imprimatur, are curios from the era. They include two poorly reviewed horror movies made in Italy.
Andy Warhol's Frankenstein is here.
After they split in the mid-1970s, Paul Morrissey told anyone who asked, including NPR in the year 2000, that Warhol took too much credit for their cinematic collaborations.
The misconception basically is that Andy was some sort of artist with a creative driving energy or something. He was the opposite of that. He was extremely limited.
On his own, Morrissey directed a few movies that made little impact and are hard to find, including one from 1982, starring a then-unknown Kevin Bacon as a grimy Times Square hustler complaining about bodega owners.
They shoot up the prices. They take over the square. They screw the numbers people, the peddlers, the loose joints, the hookers. They charge us up the pee hole.
Morrissey said his movies worked because they were funny. When asked if he felt they would hold up, Paul Morrissey said yes. He said they left a record of a specific time and place.
The way people thought and the way they didn't give a damn and the way they thought they could do whatever they wanted and get away with it. And all the time they're doing that, they're making their lives more miserable as they go along. I don't think that's a story that dates so much. So I rather enjoyed them.
Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered. At a time when it seems like political rhetoric could not get more outrageous, it might be easy to see world leaders in the worst possible light. But NPR TV critic Eric Deggan says the Netflix show The Diplomat offers a different vision of politics.
The second season of The Diplomat kicks off with a bang, quite literally.
Can you take a deep breath for me?
Aftermath of a car bomb.
Hang on. I'm so sorry. Three Americans were just blown up. I have to call the Secretary of State, the Ops Center, and the White House. You're not taking my phone.
That's Keri Russell playing no-nonsense diplomat Kate Wyler. In the show's first season, Kate was plucked from a position in the Middle East and made ambassador to Great Britain, with hopes she might eventually take over the vice president's job. But the first season ended on a cliffhanger, as Kate's husband Hal, who was a former ambassador, and two other staffers were caught in a car bomb blast while meeting with a British official. They hoped to get more information about a suspicious attack on a British warship. As the second season begins, British Prime Minister Nicol Troubridge, expertly played as a blustery, bullying egomaniac by Rory Kinnear, is still convinced Russians are behind both attacks, though his staff isn't quite so sure.
They've attacked us at sea and at home.
Two attacks would be tantamount to a declaration of war. Even Russia's unlikely to be that reckless.
Oh, of course they would. They have no red lines. They escalate in order to de-escalate. Philippa.
I would prefer a moment in private.
As would I. We're both disappointed. Pull up your trousers and speak.
This is where The Diplomat truly shines, balancing deliciously between political intrigue and emotional drama.
Somebody's going to get fired for this.
That's Ali Han, who plays savvy, effective CIA chief of station Idra Park. She tells Kate that they may have to investigate the British prime minister, which could be a problem if it becomes public. Kate is willing to put her job on the line.
I'm okay with me.
You shouldn't be. You're a public representative of the United States. I get fired, it's a secret. You get fired, we look like the vampires everybody says we are.
But it's not until West Wing alum Allison Janney arrives as current Vice President Grace Penn that the show's drama really kicks in. Penn is a brilliant manipulator who may have to resign the VP job due to her husband's financial scandal. And moments after meeting Kate, Penn isn't so sure this woman can succeed her, distracted by an item holding up Kate's pants.
Is that a paperclip?
Oh, yes, I had a zipper issue.
When you're a second-tier diplomat in a third world war zone, that may read as scrappy. If you're representing the interests of 300 million Americans whose health care is failing, whose planet is burning, whose future might get a little bit better or a little bit worse based on what you do in the course of a day, it's best to look like the care of your trousers wasn't more than you could manage.
Okay, that did sound a little West Wing-ish. Several storylines in The Diplomat revolve around smart women, including Penn, who deftly guide powerful men into making better decisions than they could manage on their own. It's also a world where politics plays out like a protracted game of 3D chess, and some government staffers still earnestly work to make the world a better place. Given our real-world political discourse, which seems more bitter and outrageous every day, watching a fictional world where many of the people who run things are smart and focused feels like a wonderful change of pace. I'm Eric Deggans.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Nick Carswell. Join me this Saturday at 5 p.m. on KPR for 105 Live, where we continue to showcase new music made right here in Kansas. Our live session this week comes from the stage at the Bottleneck with the Draper Family Band.
This is Brandon Draper from the Draper Family Band. Join us for our live studio session on 105 Live on Kansas Public Radio.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 99.5 FM in Manhattan, always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Kansas, offering a local team to help businesses invest in the health of their employees with a choice of benefit options. Learn more at bcbsks.com/business.
Stay with us. Coming up in our next half hour, Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are reaching out to voters in the Southwest today, particularly in the swing states of Nevada and Arizona. A full report coming right up. Stick around.
Support for KPR comes from the Noto Arts and Entertainment District of Topeka, inviting listeners to the Dia de los Muertos Festival on November 1st, featuring the Celebration of Souls exhibit on loan from the Chicago Field Museum. Details at explorenoto.org.
Clear skies tonight, lows in the upper 30s. Tomorrow, sunshine with a high in the lower 60s. Rain moving in Saturday evening and staying with us all the way through Election Day. Have a nearly 100% chance of rain Saturday night, Sunday night, and a 90% chance of rain on Monday. It's 10 minutes before 5. This is KPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ilsa Chang. This election, the Republican Party plans to have tens of thousands of poll watchers in key battleground states. They say it's to help maintain the integrity of the election. Democrats plan to have election observers as well, but some people worry that the large number of poll watchers could intimidate or confuse some voters and potentially disrupt the vote. Challenging voters at the polls has been a partisan strategy used for decades. Rund Abdel-Fattah and Ramtin Arablouei from NPR's history podcast Throughline bring us the story of how a future Supreme Court justice helped launch a voter challenge program in Phoenix, Arizona, that soon went national.
Before he was nominated for the U.S. Supreme Court, William Rehnquist moved to Arizona to start practicing law. It was the late 1950s.
He's already coming to Phoenix with his conservative philosophy fully baked.
This is John A. Jenkins. He wrote a book called The Partisan, The Life of William Rehnquist.
He is deeply ideological.
William Rehnquist grew up in an all-white suburb of Milwaukee. He enlisted in the Army during World War II and served until the war ended. Then he came back, got his law degree from Stanford, where he graduated first in his class, and clerked for a Supreme Court justice.
So he just had a supreme self-confidence.
Like many other cities across the country at that time, Phoenix was reckoning with Jim Crow laws and an emerging civil rights movement. And Rehnquist was part of a new conservative voice that pushed back. When the Phoenix City Council passed an anti-discrimination ordinance, he wrote a letter to the editor and spoke at the meeting.
He got noticed, and he was effective.
Rehnquist was encouraged to get involved with politics, and that meant extra scrutiny of voters in precincts that leaned Democrat. Republicans believed that many of them were voting illegally.
Here's a quote from an article in the Arizona Republic.
We in the Republican Party think that it is un-American for persons to attempt to vote in violation of the law. We are surprised that your party does not desire to manifest the same interest in correcting illegal voting procedures.
Republicans said some people used vacant lots to register their addresses, or they hadn't lived in Arizona long enough to vote. They would also send mailers to Democratic precincts. If the mail got kicked back, they would challenge those potential voters at the polls.
Which brings us to November 6, 1962, Election Day. voters lined up at an elementary school named after civil rights leader Mary McLeod Bethune. The precinct was predominantly Hispanic and Black. Later, witnesses would allege Rehnquist was there too.
The allegation was that he was showing up himself at polling places and challenging voters.
Under Arizona law, the different political parties were allowed to send delegates to the polls to challenge voters who they suspected were voting illegally. But election officials were the sole judges of a voter's qualification. So the question was, were Arizona Republicans going too far to challenge voters?
Together we will win.
What was happening in Phoenix, Arizona, was a field test for something much bigger, an operation that would be launched 2 years later during a presidential election.
And you and I are going to fight for the goodness of our land. Thank you.
In 1964, Barry Goldwater ran for president against Lyndon Baines Johnson. He and Rehnquist were both part of the so-called Arizona Mafia, a small Republican political powerhouse.
The momentum was in the Democrats' favor heading into the election, but the National Republican Party had a plan.
You may have heard of something called Operation Eagle Eye.
This is a campaign ad that Democrats released before the 1964 election.
Well, a better name for it would be Operation Evil Eye.
Republicans had already claimed that the 1960 election, 4 years earlier, was stolen. Operation Eagle Eye was the response. It was the same blueprint Rehnquist and his Republican colleagues were accused of using in Phoenix. So on the day of the 1964 presidential election, the New York Times reported Republican officials saying 100,000 trained Republican workers were in 35 key cities across the country. Operation Eagle Eye was underway.
Voters by the hundreds, perplexed and downright scared, were snarled yesterday in partisan poll watching, Miami Herald. Mexicans and Negroes complained to elections officials that they had received anonymous phone calls warning them of challenges at the polls. The New York Times.
I hope you will not be one of its victims.
Just to be clear, Operation Eagle Eye did not deliver Goldwater to the presidency.
Goldwater loses, big time.
And the story about Rehnquist challenging voters in Phoenix that went national with Operation Eagle Eye has become like many stories about mass voter challenges across the country.
Hosts Rund Abdel-Fattah and Ramtin Arablouei. You can hear the whole episode on NPR's Throughline podcast.
This story from Throughline comes from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
For the new champions of Major League Baseball, that would be the Los Angeles Dodgers, the hero of the World Series was first baseman Freddie Freeman. His four home runs capped off a year he says was the most challenging of his life, and NPR's Becky Sullivan reports.
Freddie Freeman is the first to admit he can be an emotional guy, but nothing compared to the scare he had this summer with his three-year-old son, Maximus.
Seeing one of your kids on a ventilator fighting, it was hard.
One day in July, Max woke up with a limp. By that night, he couldn't walk. It was a rare condition called Guillain-Barré syndrome. Freeman recounted rushing from stadium to emergency room. He missed 8 games and returned only when his son had turned the corner.
He's doing okay. He's on his way to being better.
Fast forward to October in the World Series against the New York Yankees.
Freeman hits the ball to right field. She is gone!
With the bases loaded in the bottom of the 10th, Freeman hit a home run to win Game 1. It was the first ever walk-off Grand Slam in the history of the World Series.
Those are the kind of things when you're 5 years old with your two older brothers and you're playing football in the backyard, and those are the scenarios you kind of dream about. That's as good as it gets right there.
Freeman homered in the next game, too. And in Game 3 and Game 4, that historic streak ended with last night's Game 5, but Freeman still had a crucial two-run single, and soon enough, he was spraying champagne in the locker room after the Dodgers had won it all. Before this, Freeman's resume was already enough for a spot in the Hall of Fame. Now he has a second ring to his name and that World Series MVP trophy, but none of it compares, he said after the game, to seeing his son get better. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
Go Dodgers! This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is now playing only in theaters. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals with a track record of excellence. More information on this year's MacArthur Fellows is at macfound.org. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. At progressive.com, not available from all agents. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
After a 16-year break, the band The Cure has come back with music that even they describe as doom and gloom. Good timing on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR News. We will hear from Jay Schaefer as well as Robert Smith and The Cure. Tune in. I'm still just shocked that The Cure is on Morning Edition. Anyway, we're live. We're local. We're Kansas Public Radio. Live radio. Gotta love it. From the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1, Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1, Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1, Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. You can listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio. It's 5 o'clock.
He is my president and he thinks I am garbage. Yeah, that definitely make me feel bad.
Voters are processing the final twists and turns of the presidential campaign as the candidates make their final pitches today in the Southwest.
For Thursday, October 31st, this is All Things Considered.
I'm Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Ahead this hour, harnessing the popularity of Mexican music as a way to harness the power of the Latino vote.
If you really want to move the needle, you really need to target that 43 out of that 63 million, which are those of Mexican descent.
Also, Sing Sing Prison just hosted its first film festival with a jury of incarcerated men.
I've never been a part of like a film festival. I've never really seen it. Didn't really think it was possible for people who grow up how we grow up.
And a new discovery in how parrots get their colorful plumage.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Abortion access is directly on the ballot in 10 states next week. It is also at stake in a less direct way when it comes to who the president is and what they might do. Here's NPR's Lisa Nadworny.
Former President Trump has said he favors leaving abortion policy up to the states. In contrast, Vice President Harris says she'd sign a bill enshrining the right to an abortion. But you can't pass legislation without Congress, and any new law would likely face legal challenges and a conservative Supreme Court. But the next president could influence abortion policy through executive power and the interpretation of existing laws and regulations. The Food and Drug Administration, for example, regulates abortion pills, and a new leader could expand access or make it harder for providers to prescribe and send pills. Presidents also appoint judges, not just to the Supreme Court, but to federal and appellate courts where abortion policy is being decided. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
The number of people detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has risen more than 20% in the past 2 years. That's according to a new report out today. NPR's Meg Anderson reports more than 36,000 people were in ICE custody this spring.
The number of people held by immigration authorities is lower than pre-pandemic, but there's been a steep increase since 2022. Researchers at the Vera Institute of Justice call that a sign of a growing criminalization of immigrants. Shana Kessler, director of the Institute's Initiative on Immigration.
What I can say is that we are very much in a moment of extremely heightened anti-immigrant rhetoric.
She says a primary reason migrants are held in custody is to ensure that they'll show up for their immigration hearing. But past research has shown that the majority of released families do show up to court. Meg Anderson, NPR News.
A semiconductor research facility in upstate New York has been named one of three national technology centers. NPR's Eva Pukach reports the facility is earmarked to receive up to $825 million in federal funding.
The center, located in Albany, New York, will focus on research into semiconductor technology known as extreme ultraviolet lithography. The Biden administration has pushed for semiconductor manufacturing to be produced domestically to increase competition with rivals like China. Since the CHIPS and Science Act passed in 2022, the federal government has invested billions into the construction or expansion of semiconductor fabrication facilities across the country. The U.S. Commerce Department has not yet announced the location of the other two national technology centers. Eva Pukach, NPR News.
Few Americans are filing claims for unemployment benefits last week. The Labor Department says initial jobless claims fell by 12,000. More closely watched October jobs numbers are due out tomorrow. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 378 points. This is NPR. In Spain, search crews are continuing to look for the bodies of people who became trapped in vehicles or flood-ravaged buildings. It follows major flash flooding in Spain's Valencia region. It has now claimed at least 158 lives, with fears the death toll there could go higher. Spain's transport minister says people appear to have drowned after being trapped inside vehicles, and many cars have yet to be checked. It's not clear how many people remain missing. Parrots have some of the most vibrant colors in the bird world, and now new research explains how they make the reds and yellows in their feathers. Science reporter Ari Daniel details how certain birds contribute to the discovery.
Researchers started with the dusky lory, a black parrot ringed with red or yellow. They traced this either-or coloration back to an enzyme that converts the parrot's red pigment into the yellow one by making a small change to the molecule. When the team looked at another kind of parrot, the rosy-faced lovebird, they found the enzyme at work there too.
So now we know definitely a little bit more about how one of the most colorful groups of animals in the world make their colors.
Roberto Arbore is an evolutionary biologist at the University of Porto. Next up, they hope to examine the genes in parrots responsible for creating the color blue. The research appears in the journal Science. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
The average rate on a 30-year mortgage took a slight bump up this week to 6.72% from just about 6.5%. This is the fifth straight week rates have moved higher after coming down slightly. However, still a year ago, the average 30-year mortgage rate was at 7.76%. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Liberty Hall Video in downtown Lawrence, with more than 11,000 titles on DVD and Blu-ray available to rent, from classics to cult. Open daily from 1 to 9 p.m. A browsable inventory is online at libertyhall.net.
It's 57 degrees in Lawrence, 59 in Topeka, 56 in Atchison. It is 5:06.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump are reaching out to voters in the Southwest today. They're in the swing states of Nevada and Arizona. We are joined by NPR's Ben Giles, who's in Phoenix, Arizona. Hi there, Ben.
Hello.
And KUNR's Lucia Starbuck in Reno, Nevada. Hi to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hey, I can hear that you're somewhere noisy, so Lucia, you kick us off there in Nevada. This is the first time, I am told, Harris has been in Reno this year. How big a deal is the visit?
Yes, I'm right outside the rally. It's a really big deal. She hasn't been to Reno since 2023 in her vice presidential capacity. She's been to Las Vegas several times since becoming the Democratic presidential candidate, and she'll be in Vegas again today. But in northern Nevada, which is more rural compared to Vegas, voters tell me they sometimes feel forgotten. Sandra Cosgrove, a history professor at the College of Southern Nevada, says these campaign visits matter.
For the community, it tells them the value of their vote. So presidential campaigns have a ton of money to be able to advertise and send mailers and text messages But if that's not working and they're really having to count individual votes, they're going to show up and talk to you.
Cosgrove said campaign visits are enough to convince people who might have sat out this election to vote.
And Ben, let me turn us to Arizona, because if you were wondering about its importance in this campaign, we can point out that both major candidates have been there a lot as well. What are the closing arguments you're hearing?
They sure have. And the Trump campaign here has been pretty consistently focused on Arizona's economy. They talk a lot about the cost of living, particularly the cost of housing and how much it's gone up. And that is top of mind for many voters here. Trump will argue the economy is worse under the Biden-Harris administration than under his 4 years ago. And they've also sought to tie the economy to immigration. They've done that by blaming migrants as added competition, contributing to the high demand of housing. Economists who've studied this question say immigrants do have a minimal impact on housing costs. That is, if supply can't keep up with demand, but again, minimal.
I'm hearing the same thing from voters in Nevada that are struggling with the high cost of living. They want to hear from both Harris and Trump on how they'll fix it, especially those working in the service industry.
Okay. Let me turn you both to some comments that have made a lot of noise, a lot of headlines in the last few days of this campaign. These are the ones from a comedian speaking before a Trump rally in New York, comparing Puerto Rico to a floating island of garbage. Given that the Southwest has a sizable Latino population, I'm curious what you're hearing from people in these two states. Lucia, first, Nevada.
Yeah, my colleague Maria Palma, she spoke to Raymond De Leon Perez, a Reno resident of Puerto Rican descent, who said it's motivating him to encourage others to vote.
Horrible, honestly. It made me feel bad. It made me feel bad for my kids, for my wife, for my family, for my Puerto Rican people. But also gave me strength to go outside and knock doors day by day and make people understand why Kamala Harris is our best choice in this next elections.
Since those comments, Trump has said he has a lot of love from Latino communities.
Ben, how about in Arizona?
Yeah, it's certainly something the Harris campaign has sought to seize on here as well. The chair of the state Democratic Party earlier this week was doing interviews on Spanish language radio channels, slamming that floating island of garbage comments made by a comedian about Puerto Rico.
Although Democrats are having to do damage control on this as well. President Biden made comments, sounded like he was calling Trump supporters garbage.
Yeah, I checked in with a couple of Republican voters in Nevada, including Paula Loop, an immigrant from Argentina.
He is my president and he thinks I am garbage. Yeah, that definitely made me feel bad, and I cared about what he said and how he said it.
She compared it to Hillary Clinton's deplorable comment she made when she was running for president in 2016. Biden has since tried to clarify his remarks, saying he was talking about the comedian at the rally, not Trump supporters.
One more issue to ask you about, and that is abortion. Ben, in Arizona, abortion's on the ballot. Polls show this measure is likely to pass. How could that impact the race?
Well, Democrats certainly think it's an issue that could play into the presidential election here. As part of their last week on the campaign trail, the Harris campaign launched a reproductive rights freedom bus tour throughout Arizona, featuring guests like former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. Democrats up and down the ballot, not just Harris, are hoping that the same people who are turning out to vote in support of a constitutional amendment to protect the right to an abortion in Arizona, that'd be up to about 24 weeks, they're hoping they'll also remember what Trump did to put the state in this situation.
And Lucia, just a few seconds left, but abortion's also on the ballot there in Nevada?
Yeah, the stakes are not as high. There's a ballot question to make it a constitutional right to have an abortion. If it doesn't pass, abortions are still protected under state law up to 24 weeks. But Democratic candidates are still making it a main campaign issue, and it's definitely on the minds of a lot of voters as well.
That is KUNR's Lucia Starbuck in Reno and NPR's Ben Giles in Phoenix. Thanks to you both.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
We've heard a lot on this show about the potential power of Latino voters, but getting Latino people out to the polls in representative numbers has been challenging. One concert promoter thinks that he has an answer, which harnesses the growing popularity of regional Mexican music. Reporter Aisha Wallace Palomares brings us a story about this Get Out the Vote campaign.
The campaign is called Grita Canta Vota, and it has its own theme song by the super popular norteño band Grupo Control. They're singing Shout, Sing, Vote. The future is in your hands. I caught up with the campaign's co-founder, concert promoter, Esau Torres, at an election event in Northern California.
Today, everyone who checks their voter registration,
Esau says the future is in the hands of Latinos because they are the second largest racial demographic in the United States, at a little over 63 million people. But they also have the lowest voter turnout.
If you really want to move the needle, you really need to target that 43 out of that 63 million, which are those of Mexican descent, which is why you hear us talking about, you know, the Tucanes, the Javis, the Banda MS, the Grupo Control.
He's name-dropping the Mexican regional artists involved in a free concert series he helped organize to register voters in battleground states like North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona, and Nevada.
So October is like our Super Bowl. We have events all over the United States.
Esau adds that if you want to encourage Mexican Americans to vote, you have to speak directly to them and do it authentically. No shade to Bad Bunny or Karol G. They're world-renowned Latino artists, but they're not Mexican. So can this Mexican regional music Super Bowl of voter registration efforts really move the needle? I asked Mike Madrid that question. He's a political strategist who wrote The Latino Century, How America's Largest Minority is Transforming Democracy. He says it's a cool way to reach out to younger voters, but he's skeptical.
They're not looking to entertainers to change their lives. They're looking to entertainers to escape from their lives. That's what entertainment often is. I'm not convinced that without a message as to why and how this is going to actually change your life, that it will work.
The free Get Out the Vote concert series ends on November 1st in Levine, Arizona, with Eslabon Armado. Probably best known for Ella Baila Sola, the first Mexican regional song to reach a billion streams on Spotify. For NPR News, I'm Aisha Wallace Palomares.
50 years ago, Muhammad Ali fought George Foreman in what is now called the Democratic Republic of Congo, the rumble in the jungle. Emmett Livingstone reports from Kinshasa.
I'm here in Kinshasa's Tata Raphael Stadium, where 50 years ago, the legendary Rumble in the Jungle fight took place between Muhammad Ali and George Foreman. For Mobutu Sese Seko, the leader of what was then known as Zaire, the title fight was an opportunity to showcase his country to the world and to lift its reputation. But for ordinary Congolese people, the event represents something much, much larger. Behind me, young Congolese boxers are circling each other in the ring, all of them inspired by Ali's victory 50 years ago.
The poorly advertised event only attracted about 100 spectators, slightly less than the 60,000 who turned up for the Rumble in the Jungle. 24-year-old Congolese boxer Landry Matete Kankonde is sitting ringside watching the bouts. He reflects on the legacy of the Rumble in the Jungle. It's like the foundations of a house. It represents a lot for us, says Balu, a silver medalist in this year's Africa Amateur Boxing Championship. Congo is a country of boxing, and most Congolese boxers draw inspiration from Muhammad Ali. 50 years ago, millions tuned in to watch the fight. The build-up had been frenzied. Ali was the underdog.
Got into the ring and I hit him with everything I had.
This is how Foreman described the fight to Mary Louise Kelly on this program back in 2016.
He survived, and after about six rounds, he started whispering, "Oh, you got George. Show me something, George." And I knew this was a frightful moment.
And in the eighth round, Ali delivered the knockout blow.
Muhammad Ali has won. Muhammad Ali has won by a knockdown.
On that night, the world's attention was for the first time focused on Congo for a positive reason. Muhammad Ali represented the pride and defiance many black Africans felt in an era of racism and apartheid. Judex Chipanda, who's 71, recalls training with Ali in Kinshasa before the fight. In 1974, he was 21 and still a competitive boxer. Chipanda even lifted the ropes for Ali as the boxer stepped into the ring. One memory sticks out. Ali Boumaye. He asked everyone to chant that. Ali Boumaye means Ali, kill him in Lingala. Chipanda and the crowd were chanting it as Muhammad Ali delivered the uppercut that knocked Foreman to the ground.
Saved him around.
It was clean and beautiful, says Chipanda. For NPR News, I'm Emmett Livingstone in Kinshasa.
This is NPR News.
This is your place for NPR News from the University of Kansas, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 89.9 FM in Atchison, always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from KU Spencer Museum of Art, now showing the exhibition Native Fashion, celebrating wearable artworks created by indigenous people historically and today. Details at spencerart.ku.edu.
Coming up in our next half-hour news headlines, then an overview of housing policies being placed out there for general consumption by former President Donald Trump and current U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris. Housing costs have been a top issue for many Americans. Very different ideas and debates for addressing the problems. We will have an overview coming up on KPR.
Support for KPR comes from the University of Kansas, transforming students and society through academics, discovery, service, and spirit. Information about the possibilities of a KU education is online at ku.edu.
Clear skies tonight, lows in the upper 30s. Tomorrow, sunshine, high in the lower 60s. 30% chance of rain late tomorrow night, lows in the mid-40s. Starting on Saturday, it is likely to rain for several days in a row. 70% chance of rain Saturday, nearly 100% chance of rain Saturday night, and again on Sunday, nearly 100% chance of rain on Sunday night, a 90% chance of rain on Monday. We could even see some into Election Day, so be ready for that. We can totally use the rain, but brings a lot of people down, so... It's 57 degrees in Lawrence, 59 in Manhattan, 58 in Abilene. It is 5:20.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is now playing only in theaters. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Across the country, anti-Trump sculptures have been popping up mysteriously. Anonymous guerrilla art has a long history in politics. So what should we take away from these new statues? Here's NPR's Andrew Limbong.
Well, it looks like a new monument downtown.
Last week, WUSA9, a local news station in Washington, D.C., reported on one sculpture.
Looks like a bronze statue of Nancy Pelosi's desk with, well,
a giant turd on it. And there's a plaque ironically honoring the, quote, brave men and women who broke into the United States Capitol on January 6, 2021 to loot, urinate, and defecate through those hallowed halls in order to overturn an election. In Philadelphia, a statue of former President Trump was placed behind an already existing statue of a nude woman with a plaque quoting his infamous line about grabbing women. And the news station, Coin6 in Portland, reported something similar.
A satirical statue of Mr. Trump suddenly appearing this morning on Southwest 6th, opposite a longtime statue of a nude woman.
This isn't abstract sculpture. You don't need an art degree to figure out what these statues are saying. But there's something going on here beyond the surface-level electoral politics, says Faye Gleiser, associate professor of contemporary art at Indiana University in Bloomington.
They're not changing how people are going to vote. That's not really the point. At the same time, I do see possibilities in them if we come to them as questions instead of answers.
One obvious question is, who put these up? An anonymous caller contacted New York Magazine, taking credit for the Philly and Portland statues, saying it was a way to remind people of certain things about former President Trump that had become, quote, forgotten or numbed or normalized. There's also the fact that whoever put up the poo desk in Washington, D.C. got a permit, which can be read as part of the art. Glaser wrote a book called Risk Work. It's an examination of guerrilla artists from the 60s or the 80s and how they evaded or didn't evade the carceral state, aka the cops. And filling out paperwork was an important part of that.
This very seemingly mundane act of having a permit for a temporary installation is actually much more revealing of the ways that artists become theorists of our everyday lives and how space is governed and managed and surveilled.
But permits are temporary, and so is art. The Portland and Philadelphia statues are already gone. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
Sing Sing is a maximum security prison north of New York City. It hosted its very first film festival last week with the help of the Marshall Project. A jury of incarcerated men weighed the merits of a variety of criminal justice documentaries and picked a winner. NPR's Mark Rivers was there.
Corrections officials brought festival guests through several layers of security and into the campus's chapel, which that day served as a meet-and-greet area. Like any film festival, there were photo ops, knots of people wearing name tags talking excitedly, a table laden with refreshments. And if you didn't notice who was wearing green slacks, you might forget that some of those guests and participants were also incarcerated.
I've never been a part of like a film festival. I've never really seen it. Didn't really think it, you know, it was possible for people who grow up how we grow up.
That's Michael Hoffler. He's incarcerated at Sing Sing, and this was a big day for him. He served on the jury, along with four other men.
We don't even know how our names got thrown in it, but we just received call-outs, and they said, all right, y'all have been chosen to participate.
Could you decline? Could you say
yeah, that? No, you could have declined. Okay. But it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
That experience came to life largely through the efforts of the Marshall Project. They brought in a filmmaker to train the men on how to judge technical aspects, like storytelling and cinematography. And the men were encouraged to use their experiences with the criminal justice system to evaluate the film's authenticity.
Their words, their thoughts have value and it has weight. And I'm glad to be able to help bring that to the world.
Lawrence Bartley was a driving force behind the event. Bartley himself had been incarcerated at Sing Sing. After his release in 2018, he joined the Marshall Project, where he creates print and video journalism. He said the Sing Sing Film Festival shines a light on the thoughts and feelings of people society tends to undervalue.
They're human beings. They're human beings with hopes and dreams and wants just like everyone else.
One of the selected documentaries was For Our Children, which centers women seeking justice for their sons who had been victims of police brutality.
It's a call to action for all mothers to come together.
We laugh, we cry, we're going to continue to fight.
Sitting in Sing Sing's auditorium, Alex Aguilar, an alternate juror, said the film made him think about his childhood.
Like, I really grew up thinking like it was normal for police pick you up, take you out your car, search your car. If they want to, they could beat you up. People don't realize how that just makes you angry because you realize like you've gone through that.
Daughters, another of the documentaries, follows the lives of four young girls as they prepare for a father-daughter dance at a D.C. prison.
These girls just needed a way to invite their fathers into their lives on their own terms.
Watching the film, Michael Hoffler thought of his own children.
Being incarcerated don't absolve us of our responsibility as a parent. We did what we did, but we still have a responsibility to help raise these children that we left.
And for Jonathan Mills, at 61, the oldest of the jurors, his experience watching the films and discussing them with the other men showed him he still had room to grow, if only given the space.
For me, it's therapeutic and a little bit healing, and it helped me develop my better social skills, you know what I mean? Because I'm, you know, a key to myself, you know what I mean? If I don't really actually know you,
I
realize that now.
The Sing Sing Festival was inspired by the first ever film festival for incarcerated men, held at San Quentin State Prison earlier this month. Rahsaan Thomas, known for co-hosting the award-winning podcast Ear Hustle, co-founded the San Quentin Festival.
What these programs do, they excuse for proximity. To bring people from different worlds together.
At Sing Sing, festival planners leaned into that proximity, giving guests, jurors, and other incarcerated men hours to mingle before the official program began. And during the program, some of those men took the chance to address top prison officials.
I think my question really is more for Commissioner Monticello.
That's one of the incarcerated men at Sing Sing, and he's directing his question about resources directly to Daniel Monticello, the commissioner of New York State's Corrections Department. Monticello stepped up to a mic and responded.
We got to figure out the staffing thing, because without that, we can't do all the things that we do. There's a lot of ideas out there, and I don't say no on first blush to any of the the ideas that are out there.
Finally, the big moment arrived. Lawrence Bartley did the honors.
The most relevant and the most deserving of the first ever Sing Sing Film Festival Award. Are y'all ready?
Contessa Gale's film, Songs from the Hole, received the top prize from the jury. She said her film, about an incarcerated musician processing his brother's death as well as his own past, belongs to the men of Sing Sing.
Every time that we've had a film festival screening on the outside, we've made sure, whatever city we're in, that we're going to also bring the film into a prison. And to have the jury here be all comprised of incarcerated people and for them to, you know, honor us with the award means everything.
Juror Alonzo Miles says, although Songs from the Hole took the top prize, all the films provided equally vital portraits of a system that he knows well but doesn't define him.
These types of films are very important. There's no loser here today when it comes to these films. All of these films are winners when you look at them and understand them.
And as today's events showed, a little understanding can go a long way. Mark Rivers, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
The English rock band The Cure broke into the pop music scene in the 1980s. Later, they took a 16-year break.
I sort of thought I'd written everything I had to write, but as it turns out, I haven't.
The return of The Cure on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Tune in tomorrow morning beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR stations for Morning Edition. Jay Schaefer will be your local host.
Support for KPR comes from the Topeka Zoo presenting Zoo Lights and the chance to host a private party or special event in a secluded igloo at the zoo. Details and reservations at topekazoo.org.
Stay with us. News headlines are coming up next. Plenty more All Things Considered still to come. We have another 90 minutes to go with you till 7 o'clock tonight. It is 57 degrees in Lawrence, 59 in Emporia. It is 5:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Today, many Hindu Americans celebrate two holidays, Diwali and Halloween.
One is a festival of lights, the other of darker things.
If you want to keep tradition alive, you have to flex, you have to just honor both, because they're also growing up in this world where all their friends aren't doing Diwali.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The presidential candidates are making a last-minute campaign stop in the Southwest today. NPR's Windsor Johnston tells us former President Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris are locked in tight races in Arizona and Nevada.
Both candidates are looking to shore up support from Latino voters in Arizona and Nevada, where border security and immigration policies hit close to home. Trump will make his closing remarks to a crowd in Henderson outside of Las Vegas. Harris will be in Reno and Las Vegas, joined by pop icon Jennifer Lopez and a Mexican rock band. Republicans are hoping to flip both Nevada and Arizona back to red after narrowly losing them in the 2020 election.
Despite concerns of outside interference influencing the results of the election, the head of the cybersecurity agency says election infrastructure is more secure than ever. The Biden administration says thousands of North Korean troops are now positioned on the border between Russia and Ukraine. Officials fear they could soon be engaging in combat with Ukrainian troops. Here's NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the U.S. believes there are 10,000 North Korean soldiers in Russia right now, as many as 8,000 of them in the Kursk region, which borders Ukraine. And Blinken says this makes Russian President Vladimir Putin look weak.
Putin has been throwing more and more Russians into a meat grinder of his own making in Ukraine. Now he's turning to North Korean troops. And that is a clear sign of weakness.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says the U.S. doesn't know what Russia is giving North Korea in exchange, but the U.S. analysts say China is none too happy about this level of coziness between Russia and North Korea. The U.S. is working diplomatic channels to urge China to intervene. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
This is NPR.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. Commissioners in Wyandotte County unanimously approved a resolution yesterday to promote expanding language access in local elections. Advocacy groups have urged the Kansas Secretary of State and the County Election Commissioner to provide voting information, ballots, and language assistance in Spanish. Micah Kubik, Executive Director of the Kansas ACLU, says language assistance would improve representation in all of the state's largest counties.
It would be a good thing for our democracy, for our community, if election-related information were available in the languages that folks here speak.
In a statement, the Kansas Secretary of State's office said it provided Spanish language election materials in other counties where federal law requires it. A literacy program at the only women's prison in Kansas is helping incarcerated mothers and grandmothers connect with their young family members. The program, operated by Fort Hays State University, helps some of the women at the Topeka Correctional Facility boost their reading ability. It also gives them confidence to read aloud to their children and grandchildren when they visit or provide recordings for their loved ones. Sarah Broman Miller is an education professor at the university, and she says the program allows women to bond with their children.
This one woman said that her daughter listened to that recording every night, and that was just her way of being tucked in by her mom.
Prison officials say the program helps with inmates' mental health and prepares them for re-entry to public life. The American burying beetle was once found in 35 states, but now it's federally threatened. Harvest Public Media's Kate Grumke reports on efforts to conserve this spooky beetle that is native to the Midwest and Great Plains.
At the St. Louis Zoo, buckets are filled with dirt, quail carcasses, and American burying beetles.
So I have here a male.
Underground, these bugs process dead animals into meatballs to feed their babies. Burying beetles are basically the cleanup crew of the ecosystem, says Kayla Garcia, the zoological manager of invertebrates.
Without animals like burying beetles, you know, we'd have a lot more like kind of dead, decaying stuff on the surface, and also a lot more flies.
A range of ecosystem changes are putting pressure on the American burying beetle. Experts say people can support these beetles and the animals they eat by planting native plants. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Kate Grumke.
Clear skies in the forecast for northeast and east central Kansas tonight. Lows in the upper 30s. Tomorrow, sunshine, a high in the lower 60s. Tomorrow night, a 30% chance of rain late. Lows in the mid 40s. We have a very good chance of rain all day Saturday, Saturday night, Sunday, Sunday night, and Monday. It's 5:35.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. The high price of housing is top of mind for many voters. Home prices have gone up 50%. That's just in the last 5 years. With the election inching very close, both candidates have promised to bring down the cost of buying or renting a home. Here to talk us through what they are proposing is NPR's Laurel Wamsley. Hey, Laurel.
Hey, Mary Louise.
So I can attest firsthand, having sold and bought houses this summer, housing prices are really high. So let's talk through what the candidates are proposing. Start with Vice President Harris.
So she talks about housing regularly in her campaign speeches, and sometimes she makes it personal. She will remember how her mother saved up to buy a home and her mother's pride when she bought it. And then Harris hits the highlights of her plan, as she did earlier this week near the White House.
As president, I will fight to help first-time home buyers with your down payment, take on the companies that are jacking up rents, and build millions of new homes.
So you heard there are a couple of key ideas that she talks about a lot. First, Harris wants to build 3 million new housing units. America is millions of housing units short, and increasing supply would help bring down rents and mortgages. Mm-hmm. So to amp up that construction, especially at the cheaper end, Harris wants to expand the existing tax credits that are used to build affordable rental housing. And she wants to create a new tax credit that would incentivize building more starter homes. All the housing experts I spoke to said that this focus on supply is the right idea. And then there's that $25,000 in down payment assistance for first-time home buyers that she mentioned, though there is some concern that that could actually drive prices higher.
Wait, hang on. Why would it drive prices higher?
Well, it's about supply and demand. And if you give a bunch of people an extra $25,000, that will increase demand, which there is already a lot of these days. I spoke to several economists, and they said that these payments to buyers will just bring more bidders for a limited number of homes, and that would drive up prices. So on the one hand, the credit for first-time buyers would help those people compete with others in this tough market, but it could just boost prices. And that extra $25,000 at the end goes to the seller.
Okay, so great time to be a seller. What about on the Republican side? What about former President Trump?
Well, one thing he's been talking about a lot is opening federal lands for housing, and that's an idea that Harris also supports. But he has other plans that are less detailed. At a rally last month in Arizona, he lamented the current mortgage rates. They were a little over 6% at the time, but Trump overstated them by several points.
Today, the mortgage rates are at 10%, 11%, 12%. You can't get the money. We're going to bring it down very fast. We're going to bring energy down. We will drive down the rates so you will be able to pay 2% again, and we will be able to finance or refinance your homes drastically.
So mortgage rates did dip below 3% at the end of Trump's presidency, but it's been more than three decades since they hit 10%, and they're far below that level now. And it doesn't set mortgage rates or interest rates, though his or her policies can affect them.
Laurel, I do want to note that Trump and his vice presidential nominee, J.D. Vance, they have both blamed undocumented immigrants for driving up housing prices. How much truth is there in that?
Well, this is another exaggeration, though there is some effect. I spoke with Albert Size. He's an economist at MIT, and he said that immigrants do increase housing prices, just like any population growth does, if the supply doesn't keep up with demand. But he said the effect is not nearly as large as the Trump campaign has made it sound. Though the effect would be larger in an area with a higher proportion of immigrants. Trump has talked about a potential mass deportation of illegal immigrants. That would mean fewer people in the country, but it would also mean fewer construction workers, and that could make building more expensive.
Thank you, Laurel.
Thanks, Mary Louise.
NPR's Laurel Wamsley.
In recent days, Puerto Rican voters in the U.S. have been at the center of the political conversation after a comedian at a Trump rally insulted their island. Now, voters on the island cannot cast a vote for the next president, but on Tuesday, they could usher in a new political era for Puerto Rico. For the first time, they could elect a governor who supports the territory's independence from the United States. That would be a rejection of the two parties that have long dominated there. Many Puerto Ricans blame them for the island's economic problems. For more, we're joined now by NPR's Adrian Florido. Hey, Adrian.
Hi, Elsa.
Hi. Okay, so tell us more about this candidate for governor and why he represents potentially big changes for Puerto Rico.
Well, his name is Juan Dalmau. He's run twice before for governor, but he's never come close to winning because he does not come from one of the two main parties. In Puerto Rico, there are no left-right parties like we have in the U.S. Mm-hmm. The political system is built around the question of the island's relationship to the U.S. So there's the party that supports Puerto Rico becoming a U.S. state and the one that wants it to remain a U.S. territory. Dalmau, this new candidate, is from a third party which supports complete independence. It's always been a minor party, but this year Dalmau is polling neck and neck with the pro-statehood candidate Jennifer González-Colón.
Interesting. So what's going on here? Like, why is this pro-independence candidate polling so well against these historically dominant parties?
Well, primarily, and somewhat ironically, Elsa, it's because he's telling voters that this debate about whether Puerto Rico should become a state or a country or remain a territory, that should be put on the back burner. Dalmau's argument is that this decades-long obsession with the status question in Puerto Rico has led local politicians to basically neglect Puerto Ricans' basic everyday needs. Mm-hmm. Good jobs, a stable power grid, decent health care. And in any case, he says local politicians have no real say on status. Any change would require congressional approval. Here's Dalmau in a video he posted this week.
Y le hemos puesto al país la oportunidad de que en estas elecciones lo que se decide no es el estatus político.
The opportunity we have in this election, he said, is to decide not our political status, but who's going to administer our government, who's going to put our house in order.
Which sounds like a pretty straightforward platform that's focused on everyday issues, right?
It is, but it's hard to overstate how radical an idea it is to put this political status question on hold, because it always has been at the heart of the island's politics. Mm. But Dalmau adopted this idea from an upstart party that first put it out there 4 years ago and that he's now in a political alliance with.
So why is their message resonating with so many people, especially now, you think?
Well, because Puerto Rico has been in an economic crisis for almost 20 years. It's been trying to claw its way out of massive crippling debt and bankruptcy. A federal control board has slashed government services. The power grid's in terrible shape. There have been corruption scandals. Young people have left in droves because they can't find jobs. And they blame all of this largely on those two main parties that have always dominated politics. This is University of Puerto Rico political scientist Mayra Vélez Serrano.
In Puerto Rico, we have to talk about the crisis generation. These young people from 18 to 30, they have not seen a Puerto Rico in progress. They just have seen a crisis after a crisis after a crisis after a crisis.
Now, Elsa, there's no guarantee that Juan Dalmau is going to win the gubernatorial election. Polls are showing a very close race between him and the pro-statehood candidate, Jennifer Gonzalez, who is the island's non-voting representative in Congress. She's got a lot of institutional support, but Dalmau's message of building up Puerto Rico, where Puerto Ricans can imagine a future for themselves, has really struck a nerve. And if he wins, it would be a big shock to Puerto Rico's entire political system.
That is NPR's Adrian Florido. Thank you so much, Adrian.
Thank you, Elsa.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Every week, a famous guest draws a card from the deck and answers a big life question on NPR's Wildcard podcast. As host of NBC's Late Night, Seth Meyers is used to focusing on politics, current events, but for his new stand-up special on HBO, Dad Man Walking, he talks more about his family life, and he kept the focus personal in his conversation with Wildcard host Rachel Martin, reflecting on his early career at Saturday Night Live.
One, two, three.
Three.
Are you good at knowing when something should end?
Yes.
Relationships?
Uh-huh.
Conversations?
Conversations, definitely.
Disagreements?
Yes, I'm very good. I hope I don't get in trouble for this. My wife and my sister-in-law were fighting once, and I walked out. It was like during a very fraught Christmas vacation. It was like too many people were in my in-law's house.
This is a classic recipe.
Yeah, just too many.
Yes.
And they were fighting in the hallway. And I came out and I screamed, "You know, some people de-escalate." And they were both very taken aback. But I disagree.
It's easier to end someone else's
I'm very fight. Good. I know when to walk away from an argument. Mm. I think I'm really good at that way. I think I'm more often than not willing to take the L.
Yeah. That's interesting.
I think I'm happy to take the L in a disagreement for the purposes of moving on.
That's a thing I would hope to be able to teach my kids, is to have the confidence and security, emotional security.
Yeah.
Because it takes that to be able to say, I don't care enough about winning this.
Yes.
You win it. And it's okay. And I'm not giving you false winning. I'm really it's okay. I'm going to walk away.
Another thing, I feel like I was I think this is true of a lot of people. I was a far more temperamental when I was younger, and things ran very hot at SNL. And there were definitely times where my instincts were to say something that would have been relationship ending to people.
Oh, really?
Just you're having an argument and, looking back, all shamefully petty,
But you didn't say those things, or did
you? No, and one of the reasons I didn't say them is because my producer and dear friend Mike Shoemaker, who works with me now, works with me at SNL, I remember once saying what, I'm going to go tell so-and-so, he's a you-know-what. And he used to always say, it's a long life. It's a long life. And the people that you work with here.
And you want a long career, yeah.
Well, it's not even about career. He's like, look, the people you work with here, what you are going through with them is going to, even for the ones that aren't your favorite people, this is bonding. And you will need, for the rest of your life, you will need these relationships to remember what this time was like. Mm-hmm. And these people, more of them are going to be at your wedding that aren't. And so I'm very happy I lived by the adage of it's a long life. Because if it's somebody you think might be your friend in the future, there's no reason to burn it down in the present.
The new special is called Dad Man Walking. You can see it on HBO Max. It's very funny. It's worth your time. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you. Thank you.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from Angie, dedicated to helping homeowners find skilled pros to get their home projects done well, from everyday repairs to major remodels. Reviews, pricing, and booking are at Angie.com or on the Angie app.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
We are in the final stretch of this historic election season. Former President Trump and Vice President Harris are making their last big push before it all comes to a head on November 5th. I'm Scott Detrow. Join us for live special coverage of Election Night 2024 from NPR News. We will bring you the latest as the polls close and the vote totals roll in, with the context and analysis you need to stay informed.
Join us Tuesday night on your KPR One stations beginning at 7 o'clock. NPR's coverage of election results. Again, that'll be on KPR One.
Creating a legacy in public radio is as easy as adding KPR to your will and becoming a member of the Dick Wright Legacy Society. A bequest can help ensure our on-air service will continue for years to come. For more information, visit kansaspublicradio.org.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 90.3 FM in Chanute, always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from Dr. Stephen H. Chronister, Healing Smiles, located in downtown Topeka, offering dental services with an emphasis on dentures and implants with all current health and safety protocols. More at drchronister.com.
Stay tuned. News headlines are coming up at 6:01. Then we will learn more about the situation involving North Korean troops turning up on the border of Ukraine. We will talk about Election Day anxiety and how to combat it. Also, an overview of some of the best horror movies of the year, all coming up on KPR. Lows in the upper 30s tonight, sunshine tomorrow with a high in the lower 60s. It's 57 degrees in Lawrence, and it is 10 minutes before 6.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. It's October 31st, Halloween, which means millions of people are prepping their costumes and planning for trick-or-treaters. But for Hindus, Sikhs, and Jains, today is a holy day, too. Diwali, also known as the Festival of Light. From member station WFCR, New England Public Media's Nirvani Williams shows us how some Hindus are preparing to celebrate two very distinct holidays today.
You might remember this pop culture Diwali moment from The Office.
What is Diwali, you may ask? Well, that is essentially a Hindu Halloween.
Actually, that's not even close. As usual, Michael Scott from The Office is more than a little off. Diwali, pronounced with a V, is actually the Hindu Festival of Lights, which celebrates the triumph of good over evil and signifies renewal.
Hi, Vyasi. How are you?
Saritha Reddy is shopping for her Diwali celebration. She's holding a diamond-shaped cashew fudge in her hand, a favorite Indian sweet of hers called Kaju Katli.
This one have like saffron and rose petals in it. And if you see this is like a dry fruit filling like inside the sweet.
After she leaves the Indian grocery store here in West Springfield, she's also running over to Costco to grab candy. Her family is celebrating both.
Growing up here, they are like, you know, want to celebrate both of them, and they are giving some time for Diwali to celebrate, so I'm happy.
I like Halloween like a little, just like a little bit better because like I get to go trick-or-treating with my friends and get like lots of candy.
That's her 14-year-old son, Akshaj, who has a plan for the evening. He says after school, he'll change into a traditional Indian kurta outfit and have a small puja or moment of prayer dedicated to Lakshmi, the goddess of prosperity, with his family. Then he'll hit the streets for sweets.
I want to wear like a karate gi and like be like a character from my favorite TV show. It's called Cobra Kai.
But at a recent Indian folk dance festival, there were a variety of opinions about the overlap of Diwali and Halloween this year. 11-year-old Anjuri Gandhi, just a few years younger than Akshaj, says she prefers to keep the holidays separate because it's hard to find an outfit for both, and
they're like two different holidays, and it's like, it would be weird celebrating them together. It's like you're celebrating two, like, opposite things on the same day.
Diwali is typically a five-day festival where the biggest celebration, the lighting of candles called diyas, happens on the third day. 50-year-old Lena Thacker says a blend of holidays may just be too confusing for her nieces and nephews.
So it's hard to, with Halloween, it's very like the opposite, right? Like it's very dark and it becomes really difficult to blend. So it's better to enjoy each festival separately on its own.
But 24-year-old Nishta Patel says both can be celebrated together.
If you want to keep tradition alive, you have to flex, you have to adjust and keep up with the times and let them do both, honor both, because they're also growing up in this world where all their friends aren't doing Diwali.
And along with sharing American candy, Saritha Reddy says she can share her culture too.
I'm excited that Diwali will reach more people as they're falling on the same day.
So whether you're reaching for a Kit Kat bar, Kaju Cutli, or both, one thing's for certain, your sweet tooth will definitely be satisfied today. For NPR News, I'm Nirvani Williams in Springfield, Massachusetts.
We hear a lot about red and blue in politics. What about the colors that Polly has picked? Ari Daniel reports on how parrots create the yellows and reds in their plumage.
Some birds are feathered tufts of color, so resplendent they do anything but blend in with their surroundings.
You have to ask why birds would do this. And one of the leading hypotheses is that the male has elaborate ornaments or colors that are attractive to the female.
Joe Corbo is a biologist at Washington University in St. Louis. Consider for a moment the goldfinch or the cardinal.
Most birds that have bright yellow or red feathers are using carotenoids to make those colors.
Carotenoids are a kind of pigment.
The reason that a bird's egg's yolk is a bright yellow orange is because it's full of carotenoids. And so then during development, the bird mobilizes the carotenoids from the yolk and then deposits them in the developing feathers.
And then, much like people need vitamins from food because the human body doesn't make them, once the chicks hatch, the only way for birds to get carotenoid pigments is for them to eat them.
So they obtain them from their diet.
There is a notable exception, however, and that is parrots. Roberto Arbore is an evolutionary biologist at the University of Porto in Portugal.
Parrots do it different. They synthesize their own pigments. They do not rely on what they get from the diet.
Scientists have known about these special pigments, but not really how parrots use them to create their diverse colors. So Arbore and his colleagues turned to the dusky lory, a parrot the size of an eggplant.
It's a very obscure species that lives in remote places. They come from Papua New Guinea.
The dusky lory is black and ringed with one of two colors.
Red or yellow.
The yellow color is actually dominant to the red genetically.
Joe Corbo says they were able to trace this either-or coloration, this red versus yellow, back to a single gene, one that they found makes an enzyme that shows up in lots of creatures. But in the dusky lory, the enzyme converts the red pigment into the yellow one by making a small change to the molecule.
And so the animal appears to be able to control the expression levels of this enzyme and thereby tune the relative ratio of red to yellow pigment.
When Corbo and his colleagues looked at another kind of parrot, the rosy-faced lovebird, they found the enzyme at work there too, doing the same thing. They suspect it's true in a wide range of parrot species. Just to be sure they had it right, though, they took the enzyme out of the birds and put it into yeast. Yes, yeast, and found it again made the color change they expected.
And this was the final proof. So now we know definitely a little bit more about how one of the most colorful groups of animals in the world make their colors.
The research is published in the journal Science.
It is a huge step forward in avian color genetics.
Rosalind Price Waldman is an evolutionary biologist finishing up her PhD at Princeton University who wasn't involved in the research. She says the findings open the door to asking what else these colors may reveal about parrots.
People are very interested in like what the pigment content of a feather can tell us about an organism's health or stress or other aspects of its biology.
As for Roberto Arbore, he agrees this is just the beginning.
I will say it actually adds a new layer of magic. I never worked with parrots before, and now I'm considering working on them for the rest of my career.
Next up, Arbore says he and his colleagues want to examine the genes in parrots responsible for creating the color blue. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
Irish writer Bram Stoker is well known for his novel Dracula, but years before that came out, he wrote another story that was lost for more than a century. That is, until someone recently found it, and the discovery has Stoker fans super stoked.
Immediately called each other, and I think probably swore more times than we ever have collectively on a phone call before, because we immediately thought, this is huge, this is global.
That story tomorrow on All Things Considered. Listen on your radio, online, or by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your local station by name.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from EBSCO, offering EBSCO Learning, committed to enabling organizations and people seeking to advance their lives and careers to improve their skills and knowledge. Learn more at EBSCOLearning.com. From the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. From the Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. utgrantfdn.org.
After a 16-year break, the band The Cure has come back with music that even they describe as doom and gloom. Good timing on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR stations for Morning Edition. We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3, K210CR Atchison 89.9, K258BT Manhattan 99.5, and at kansaspublicradio.org. It's 6 o'clock.
We have never let up. We organize 12 months a year. This is how we win, is by showing up all the time.
In the final days before the election, we check in on the get out the vote efforts for both the Trump and Harris campaigns.
It's Thursday, October 31st, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. If you are struggling with pre-election anxiety right now, we got some advice for you.
This is the week to pull out the business card of the therapist that has been sitting in the bottom of your purse for a couple months.
Also, the Biden administration says about 10,000 North Korean troops are now in Russia.
And it's Halloween. No better way to spend the evening than watching something scary and weird.
Not everything in the movie has to be explained, nor does it have to make sense. And I love it because it lets you just kind of exist in the horror and you leave with questions.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Former President Donald Trump is taking a detour from the seven key battleground states in the final days of the campaign. The GOP presidential contender was in Albuquerque, New Mexico today and is in Nevada tonight. NPR's Ben Giles is in Phoenix, Arizona, and details some of the key issues he'll be pushing to voters there.
The Trump campaign here has been pretty consistently focused on Arizona's economy. They talk a lot about the cost of living, particularly the cost of housing and how much it's gone up. And that is top of mind for many voters here. Trump will argue the economy is worse under the Biden-Harris administration than under his 4 years ago. And they've also sought to tie the economy to immigration. They've done that by blaming migrants as added competition, contributing to the high demand of housing.
NPR's Ben Giles. Trump makes a stop in Salem, Virginia, Saturday. Democrat Kamala Harris says her rival Donald Trump's comments about protecting women, whether they, quote, like it or not, shows the Republican presidential nominee does not understand women's rights to make decisions about their own lives. Harris made her remarks in Wisconsin before setting out for other campaign appearances today in Arizona and Nevada. Pennsylvania has been one of the most closely watched states in this year's presidential race. Less than a week from the election, many voters have already made up their minds, but others are on the fence. NPR's Windsor Johnson spoke to both groups.
Sarah Hutchins is a registered Democrat in Bucks County, a suburb of Philadelphia. She says protecting reproductive freedom is a major concern for her.
I'm a mom of two girls, and I am a mom of two miscarriages. You know, women's rights is really, really important to me.
Alice Broadley lives in Meadville in the northwestern part of the state. She's a registered Republican and says she hasn't decided on whether to vote.
I'm not enthusiastic about either person. It doesn't matter to me what party they belong to. It's the personality and the past history.
Recent polling shows roughly 3% of Pennsylvania voters say they're still undecided. Windsor Johnston, NPR News.
An IV fluid production plant damaged by Hurricane Helene is partially back online, NPR's Sydney Lupkin reports.
A Baxter International factory in North Carolina had to shut down more than a month ago because of flooding from Hurricane Helene. Before being knocked out of commission, the factory made 60% of the IV fluids used in hospitals around the country. The resulting shortage means hospitals are conserving IV bags for the neediest patients and postponing or canceling some procedures. The Biden administration invoked the Defense Production Act to help Baxter get materials needed to clean and rebuild the factory. Now Baxter is restarting production lines of the most commonly used IV fluids. It'll take time for the new supplies to reach hospitals, however. The first batches of IV fluids won't be shipped until late November, Baxter said. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
The Dow is down 378 points. This is NPR. Israeli officials say a rocket barrage fired from Lebanon has killed at least 7 people in northern Israel. The rocket's hitting an agricultural area along the border near the city of Haifa. Back-to-back attacks today representing the deadliest spate of strikes in Israel since the Israeli military invaded the country earlier this month. For over a year, Lebanon's Hezbollah militant group has been firing rockets, drones, and missiles into Israel. Some 1.2 million people in Lebanon have been displaced since Israel's escalation. The Bill Gates Company says plans are back on track to bring nuclear power to Wyoming to replace its retiring coal plants. NPR's Kirk Siegler reports the highly publicized project has been delayed due to the war in Ukraine.
Bill Gates' company TerraPower is building a zero-emission nuclear power plant adjacent to the site of a coal plant that's slated for retirement. But supply chain disruptions caused by the war have made it difficult to get the uranium it needs. TerraPower now says it's secured contracts with a South Africa-based supplier, and the company plan to open the plant by the end of this decade is back on. There's a lot of attention on this Wyoming nuclear plant and whether it will be as easy as promised to retrain former coal workers. The nation's top coal producer, Wyoming, is scheduled to retire all of its coal power plants by 2039 due to utility company climate plans and overall less demand for coal. Kirk Sigler, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices moved in the opposite direction of stocks today, extending their gains. Oil rose by 65 cents a barrel to settle at $69.26 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include ECMC Foundation, whose North Star is to eliminate equity gaps in post-secondary completion by 2040 so that underserved learners have greater opportunity for social and economic mobility.
From the University of Kansas, this is KPR, Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from the Topeka Zoo, celebrating 90 years of smiles, memories, wildlife conservation, and education. Open daily from 9 to 5. Calendar of events and ticket information is found at topekazoo.org.
It's 54 degrees in Lawrence, 57 in Manhattan. It is 6:06.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. Election day is now right around the corner. While the candidates are still working to persuade the sliver of undecided voters, the parties are working at full force behind the scenes, checking lists of voters, making calls, knocking on doors to make sure people get out to the polls. But the two campaigns are taking different strategies this year to getting out the vote. Two of our correspondents who've been watching this are here to talk about it. And I want to start with NPR's Asma Khalid, who's been covering the Harris campaign. Asma, what does the Harris get out the vote effort look like?
Well, it is an ambitious effort. The campaign says it has roughly 2,000 staffers and 250 offices across the key swing states. Now, in terms of what that operation looks like, it's a combination of traditional phone banking and door knocking, you know, volunteers just making cold calls. And then it's also about relational organizing, people texting, say, friends and family. One thing I think that is worth pointing out is that when Harris became the Democratic nominee and replaced Joe Biden at the top of the ticket, there was this sudden surge of organic enthusiasm among different demographic groups. You probably remember those Zoom calls, right? It was like white women for Harris, Indian Americans for Harris. And even though these are ostensibly unaffiliated with the campaign, they are an extremely powerful organizing tool that, you know, frankly, Democrats did not have before.
You mentioned those demographic groups. Who exactly is the Harris campaign trying to reach in these final days?
Yeah, I mean, the campaign has a three-pronged vision in the key states, and it's pretty similar whether you're talking about Georgia or Pennsylvania. First off, the goal is to solidly win the cities. Secondly, they're trying to win the suburbs convincingly, and they think they have an edge on issues like reproductive rights and the threat that they believe Trump poses to democracy. They think that this could really resonate with college-educated voters in the suburbs. And lastly, they are trying to lose by less in rural areas. And to me, Ari, this is really interesting because to this point, you know, as an example, the campaign says about a third of their Pennsylvania offices are in counties Trump won by double digits last time.
So that's the Democratic strategy. And Republicans and the Trump campaign are trying something different with their voter outreach. So let me bring in NPR's Stephen Fowler to tell us, what does that effort look like, Stephen?
So, Ari, it's hard to directly compare the offices and staff and resources in these swing states. There's no direct comparison because Republicans don't share those numbers to the same degree, but it is less than the Democrats, partially because Republicans' key focus is on this program. It's called Trump Force 47. They're relying on grassroots volunteers with a lot of enthusiasm to be the ones doing the door knocking, talking to their own neighbors and friends in their communities, and also talking to people who don't often vote instead of primarily using paid canvassers. Now, the canvassers are still there, but those are handled mainly by third-party groups run by people like Turning Point's Charlie Kirk and billionaire Elon Musk. Here's Musk speaking at a Trump rally in Butler, Pennsylvania.
So thank you, and honestly, you want to just be a pest. Just be a pest to everyone you know, people on the street, everywhere. Vote, vote, vote. Fight, fight, fight. Vote, vote, vote.
But as you hear, these groups are inexperienced, and some Republicans I've talked to are worried about voters falling through the cracks.
How much does the ground game actually matter, Stephen?
Well, Republicans are seeing some of the fruits of their labor. There's been a surge in Republican turnout in many states so far, both of people who normally wait until election day to vote and those who may be early voting earlier. That, in theory, is going to free up more time and resources for Republicans to target those harder to convince voters to show up between now and Tuesday. It's also the third time Trump has run for president, and the campaign feels like Trump himself is the only get-out-the-vote effort they need to get them across the finish line.
You know, to that point, Stephen, you mentioned this is the third time that Trump is running. It's also the third time Democrats are running against Trump. And so they feel like they've got experience here. You know, I recall covering the 2016 election cycle, and the Democrats were essentially sort of blindsided by the organic enthusiasm for Trump. Ben Wickler is the chair of the Wisconsin Democratic Party, and he told NPR that after that shocking loss in 2016, they started a year-round organizing effort.
We have never let up. We organize 12 months a year. We organize in school board elections all the way to presidential elections. When there's no election, we have kind of mock dry runs and go knock on people's doors and check in with them about what they're thinking. This is how we win, is by showing up all the time.
Democrats feel they have really learned their lesson, and they know this election could be decided by just a few thousand votes in a couple of states.
NPR's Asma Khalid and Stephen Fowler, thank you both.
Good to speak with you.
Thank you.
The Biden administration says North Korean troops may soon be directly involved in Russia's war against Ukraine. That is according to the latest U.S. intelligence reports. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports this would mark a major escalation in Russia's nearly three-year-long war against Ukraine.
According to the latest U.S. assessments, there are about 10,000 North Korean soldiers in Russia. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says 8,000 of them have already deployed to the Kursk region. That's the Russian region that Ukrainian forces invaded this past summer.
We've not yet seen these troops,
deploy into combat against Ukrainian forces, but we would expect that to happen in the coming days. Russia has been training DPRK soldiers in artillery, UAVs, basic infantry operations, including trench clearing, indicating that they fully intend to use these forces in frontline operations.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says the North Koreans have been given Russian uniforms and equipment.
Make no mistake, if these North Korean troops engage in combat or combat support operations against Ukraine, they would make themselves legitimate military targets.
Russia's ambassador to the United Nations told the Security Council meeting Wednesday that his country's military cooperation with North Korea is transparent and part of a strategic partnership. Austin says it's a sign of weakness because Russia is suffering high casualties on the battlefield in Ukraine.
By tin-cupping to North Korea for manpower, Putin is showing the world another clear sign of weakness. The Kremlin's North Korean gambit just underscores how badly Putin's war has gone and how much trouble he's in. This is the first time in more than a century that Russia has welcomed foreign troops onto its own soil.
He says China, which Washington believes can pressure both Russia and North Korea, should be taking this seriously and asking Russia some hard questions. South Korean defense and foreign ministers echo that and say they might send weapons to Ukraine in response. At their meeting at the State Department, the U.S. and South Korean officials also expressed alarm over North Korea's latest test of an intercontinental ballistic missile. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Around Halloween, a trip to a cemetery can be part of a spooky adventure, a place where people gather to tell ghost stories. As Julie Denishay of member station KCUR reports, for some, visiting a graveyard is a way of preserving history.
It's a sunny fall day, and the leaves are just beginning to turn on the trees at Kansas City's Historic Union Cemetery. About 20 people have gathered at the caretaker's cottage, a white clapboard house near the entrance.
Thank you so much for signing up for taking the class today. We're going to go on a little bit of a hike because we're going to go over to an area that's called Founders Row.
Heather Ferries is vice president of the Cemetery's Historical Society, which helps preserve the city's oldest public burial ground. There are 5,000 marble and granite markers here. Ferries will be teaching the group how to clean the gravestones without damaging them.
There's quite a few larger stones up there that we're going to work on today. If the stone has an orange flag, it's good to go. You can clean it, you can scrub it.
Earlier this year, the cemetery was awarded a grant to help preserve the tombstones. So far, volunteers have cleaned more than 300 of them. This group totes buckets and brushes as they pass the graves of John Calvin McCoy, often called the father of Kansas City, and Pony Express operator Alexander Majors. When volunteers, Savannah Jones Beachy is not cleaning headstones. She works on the weekend to help digitize cemetery records.
For me, it's very meaningful. I really enjoy getting to look up the facts about the people so they're not just a stone. Sometimes these people's names haven't been spoken in hundreds of years.
Kaylin Witt co-hosts a dark history podcast called Ghoul's Night Inn that explores the culture and traditions of all things spooky. For her, there's nothing scary about being in the cemetery. She kneels in front of a marble tombstone decorated with carved scrolls and flowers.
I picked this one because it's really beautiful.
The epitaph is obscured by a thick layer of lichen. Witt sprays the marker with a biodegradable cleaning fluid that loosens the lichen without damaging the stone.
This is a very young person who was 18 years at the time of their passing, so I just want to give him some extra special attention today.
Witt gently scrubs away years of dirt with the bristles of a brush.
I've just always been fascinated by keeping people's memory alive and different ways that we do that as humans. It's such a human thing that we all do.
And as she scrubs, more details and carvings start to become uncovered.
So we can now see that this is a McCoy.
Turns out it's the gravestone of Spencer C. McCoy, the only son of the founder of Kansas City. Spencer McCoy was born in 1844. He joined the Confederate Army and died during a Civil War battle in 1863. Both Union and Confederate graves can be found here, resting together. For Savannah Jones Beachy, working in the cemetery is her way of engaging with people from the past.
I like to talk to the person as I clean their stone. Some people might find that creepy or weird, but I think it's just very endearing to know that people are still here caring about you even when you've left the world.
There's nothing scary or ghostly at all about the work they're doing. It's all about preserving history and honoring the dead. For NPR News, I'm Julie Denechet in Kansas City.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From the University of Kansas, this is Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 91.3 FM in Junction City, always online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the University of Kansas, transforming students and society through academics, discovery, service, and spirit. Information about the possibilities of a KU education is online at ku.edu.
Thanks so much for joining us this evening. Happy Halloween. Quick reminder, slow down if you're out driving tonight. The very dangerous night for driving. A lot of pedestrians, a lot of times wearing dark costumes. Just be extra careful. You can get wherever you need to go 30 seconds later. That's what my father tells me to this day. At any rate, thanks for tuning in. It's an update of news headlines. Before we get to 7 o'clock, we will talk about Freddie Freeman winning MVP for the World Series. Becky Sullivan has that story coming right up. Stick around.
Support for KPR comes from the Lead Center, welcoming the classical trio of Edgar Meyer, Tessa Lark, and Joshua Roman, performing on bass, violin, and cello. Sunday, November 3rd, 2 p.m. Tickets are at lead.ku.edu.
Following All Things Considered on your KPR One stations, we have Classics Live, and it is a broadcast of Destiny's Spooky Halloween Concert from Live Day. It's followed by more Destiny. Isn't everything? Happy Halloween and Tango Thursday for you. Spooky tunes and one of the most famous tangos of all time. It's coming up on your KPR One stations. On KPR Two at 7 o'clock, we have KPR Presents. 54 degrees in Lawrence. The time is 6:20.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is now playing only in theaters. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. I was out to dinner this past week, big group, when someone at our table asked for two glasses of wine. Now, I am not one to judge, but I do ask questions for a living. And her response to me was, I am so stressed about this election. She's not alone.
Welcome back to CBS Saturday Morning. We begin this half hour with anxiety over the coming presidential election.
It seems like no matter where you go these days, you can't avoid it. You're flipping channels, ads.
Yes, some doctors are reporting a growing number of people with election-related sleep issues.
Well, one of those doctors is Lucy McBride, doctor of internal medicine with a private practice here in D.C., also a prolific podcast host and newsletter author, and she has just written about managing our election anxiety. Lucy McBride, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So the headline here seems to be that everyone is stressed out, and I will cite data. This is a new report from the American Psychological Association that finds almost three-quarters of adults, 7 out of 10 American adults, say the future of the nation is a significant source of stress in their lives. Does that square with what you are hearing from patients?
Absolutely. I think if you're watching the news, if you're paying attention, frankly, if you're breathing air, you are noticing a certain degree of anxiety in most people. Yeah. And I'm seeing it in my office. I'm seeing it in my patients. I can see it in their faces. I see it in their blood pressure readings. And I hear it based on the behaviors they're using to cope. Patients report having a gravitational pull to the Halloween candy and to wine and to other self-soothing behaviors that they really know they shouldn't do but can't help.
Some of the guidance that you counsel is stuff that's not hugely surprising, but I found it so reassuring just to be reminded of it. Things like take a walk, book a yoga class. What else?
This is the week to pull out the business card of the therapist that has been sitting in the bottom of your purse for a couple months. This is the week to book that yoga class. It's also the week to prioritize rest and to prioritize calm and doing things that are non-political, watching a movie about cats or puppies or something benign.
I mean, you also counsel something which I am professionally obligated to object to, but you say we should be taking breaks from the news.
Yes, we are not wired to take in all of this information, to interpret all this information. It's important to take breaks. You can stay informed and still dose yourself with enough news to keep you informed, but not to agitate you, to keep you up at night.
Your last piece of advice is, it feels more like advice to us as citizens than advice as a doctor to patients. It's to go out and vote. Is there a health benefit to this, or are you just asking us to fulfill our civic duty?
If you think about anxiety as the absence of control, right? Anxiety hates the absence of control. The way you can exert some control over our election is to vote, to talk to your friends, to talk to your neighbors, join a phone bank. To exercise your independence and your voice is one way to quell anxiety and to feel like you've made a difference.
Meanwhile, have you eaten all of the Halloween candy?
Oh my gosh, the Halloween candy is just disappearing piece by piece. There are wrappers all over the kitchen counter. So I'm hoping we have some left for the trick-or-treaters tonight.
Okay. I will fight you for the last mini Snickers. Lucy McBride, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Let me ask you, is there anything scarier than an evil Santa Claus?
He's scaring my kid.
Yeah, he's scaring me too.
Hey, Santa's handing out presents!
Or how about Satan?
It's the mark of the devil.
Or even aging?
Have you ever dreamt of a better version of yourself? Younger, more beautiful.
I certainly have. These are all horror movies that came out this year. And yes, my friends, it is that time of year again when I scare myself on purpose by talking to Rebecca McKendry. She's a director and critic of horror movies, and she joins us now to round up her favorites of the year. Hello, hello, Rebecca.
Hello. It is awesome to be back doing this again, talking about my favorite subject.
We love it when you stop by, All Things Considered. So just before we get into how things are changing, just what were your favorite horror movies that you have seen this year?
I love to leave the theater saying I have never seen anything like that. If I'm still processing it 12 hours later, that was a good movie in my mind. So The Substance is definitely up there. It's about aerobics instructor who is getting really concerned about her career because she's aging, and she is presented with this drug that will supposedly allow her to live as a younger person so she can continue with her career.
That's amazing. Who wouldn't want that?
Sounds great. See the movie. Doesn't turn out that way.
Ah.
There's been a slight misuse of the substance.
It's hyper gory. It's body horror. It's weird. It's putting major actresses into kind of these weird, uncomfortable positions. But seeing it with a crowd in a theater, everyone was howling.
By that, you mean laughing. Not like howling like werewolves.
I do kind of mean howling like werewolves.
What?
Like in shock. Like, oh my gosh, I can't believe what I'm watching. Like just gasps. And then I also have to give a really big shout out to Abigail, which I loved. This was a bigger film about a ballerina vampire.
Okay. How do we kill a vampire? What are we talking about? Like an Anne Rice or a True Blood, you know, Twilight?
Just kind of this like oddball out idea out of left field, but it worked.
Every time that we have you on the show, Rebecca, you tell us about some unifying aspect that defined each year. What is this year's biggest horror trend? Like any themes that you saw repeated?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So the themes, I have seen a lot of franchises, IPs, mm-hmm. reboots, sequels. The second trend that I'm seeing is this concept of surreal and absurdist, that not everything in the movie has to be explained, nor does it have to make sense. And I love it because it lets you just kind of exist in the horror and you leave with questions. The last trend that I'm really seeing is hyperviolence. Wow. And I am so excited to see this come back. This is something that... I know.
A quote we usually don't hear guests on NPR say, but go on, Rebecca McKendry.
So I think that the reason behind this is always that for certain people, it's cathartic. I can go into a film like The Substance that is hyper, hyper gory, and somehow I can walk out of that and say, I feel better.
You know, when you were first saying that you were so excited to see gore come back, my first thought is, man, you are a sicko, Rebecca. But now that you're explaining it, you're actually quite mentally healthy. You're dealing
with it.
Thank you.
I always think of it, I use the phrase, taste death, live life. Because I think that, you know, we each kind of have the thing that we do to kind of make ourselves feel how alive we are, whether you are skydiving or getting a tattoo or riding roller coasters. And for a lot of us, we find that kind of refreshing extreme, like, oh my gosh, okay, I feel more alive from watching extreme horror films. And at the end of the day, I consider it to be incredibly healthy because I walk out of them going, okay, you know what? I was feeling bad. Now I feel great. I'm going to go get a cup of coffee and thank myself for being alive. So yeah.
That is Rebecca McKendry, horror director and film critic. Thank you so much once again for being here, and happy Halloween, Rebecca.
Happy Halloween. Thank you so much for having me.
This is NPR News.
The English rock band The Cure broke into the pop music scene in the 1980s. Later, they took a 16-year break.
I sort of thought I'd written everything I had to write, but as it turns out, I haven't.
The return of The Cure, tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
The latest national, international, and regional news, plus The Cure. Jay Schaefer will be your local host. Join us for Morning Edition tomorrow, 5 to 9 a.m. on your KPR stations.
Support for KPR comes from the Taco Zone Catering, your locally owned and operated small business featuring a reimagined menu and expanded catering options for larger parties. Details at thetacozone.com.
Stay tuned. News headlines are coming up next. It's 54 degrees in Lawrence, 57 in Manhattan, 62 in Chanute. It's 6:30.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A huge portion of Nevada voters don't belong to any major party,
which makes election results very hard to predict in that state.
There is a large number of very young voters who are registered nonpartisan, who feel disengaged and alienated from the political parties.
No news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. 5 days left before Election Day, and both presidential campaigns trying to connect with female voters and anyone still undecided. Vice President Kamala Harris spoke in Wisconsin today before setting out to campaign in the western battleground states of Nevada and Arizona. Harris pushing back on Republican nominee Donald Trump's comments today that he would protect women whether they like it or not. Harris calling it offensive to everybody.
Our campaign really is about bringing people together. People of very different and diverse backgrounds around a common theme that is about love of country, defending the Constitution of the United States, and investing in our future, and rejecting the notion that we are divided or that that should be acceptable, that we would be divided as a nation.
Meanwhile, former President Trump is campaigning in New Mexico and Virginia, where Republican presidential candidates haven't won in decades. In Washington, a House panel investigating the national response to the COVID-19 pandemic is urging a criminal probe of former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. NPR's Brian Mann says the Republican-led committee alleges Cuomo, a Democrat, lied in testimony.
Cuomo has long faced criticism for his handling of nursing home residents hit hard by COVID-19. Republican members of the House Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Pandemic say the former governor made criminally false statements during an interview about his role with the panel back in June. They urged the DOJ to consider criminal charges. Cuomo denies any wrongdoing. His attorneys filed their own complaint with the DOJ, claiming the House panel's work is biased. This Republican effort to bring charges against Cuomo comes as former President Donald Trump is promising to use the DOJ to prosecute political opponents if he wins next week's election. Brian Mann, NPR News.
I'm Duane Brown. You're listening to NPR.
For Kansas Public Radio News, I'm Laura Lorson with your regional headlines. Commissioners in Wyandotte County unanimously approved a resolution yesterday to promote expanding language access in local elections. Advocacy groups have urged the Secretary of State and the County Election Commissioner to provide voting information, ballots, and language assistance in Spanish. Micah Kubik, Executive Director of the Kansas ACLU, says language assistance would improve representation in all of the state's largest counties.
It would be a good thing for our democracy, for our community, if election-related information were available in the languages that folks here speak.
In a statement, the Kansas Secretary of State's office said it provided Spanish language election materials in other counties where federal law requires it. A literacy program at the only women's prison in Kansas is helping incarcerated mothers and grandmothers connect with their young family members. The program, operated by Forte State University, helps some of the women at the Topeka Correctional Facility boost their reading ability. It also gives them confidence to read aloud to their children and grandchildren when they visit or provide recordings for their loved ones. Sarah Broman Miller is an education professor at the university. She says the program allows women to bond with their children.
This one woman said that her daughter listened to that recording every night, and that was just her way of being tucked in by her mom.
Prison officials say the program helps with inmates' mental health and prepares them for re-entry to public life. As trick-or-treaters are getting their costumes ready to go, scientists are busily working to save a spooky native bug whose numbers have plummeted. The American burying beetle takes animal carcasses underground to feed its young. It used to be in 35 states, but now it's in just a handful, including Kansas. Oklahoma State University entomology professor Wyatt Hoback has studied this beetle for 26 years, says they're a conservation challenge.
They're wide-ranging, and they need carcasses. So it's really hard to manage specifically for them.
Hoback says the good news is that protecting burying beetle habitat also protects a lot of other plants and animals in the Midwest and the Great Plains. It's 53 degrees in Lawrence. The time is 6:35.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations meet their food needs, from online ordering to simplified expense reporting, with a nationwide network of restaurants all on one platform. Learn more at easycater.com. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Nevada is about as purple as a swing state can get. 4 in 10 registered voters there are not affiliated with either major political party. Nonpartisan voters are the largest single group in the state. And as NPR's Jung Yoon Han reports, it's unclear what curveball those nonpartisan voters will throw.
Julian Herrera knows who he's voting for, and it's Donald Trump. He thinks Trump would handle the economy better than Vice President Harris would.
It's been much worse with Joe Biden, and I just don't understand what would be different since she's already been the VP for 3.5 years.
Herrera, who's 22, voted for Trump in 2020 as well. The only difference is that he has since unregistered himself from the Republican Party.
The people that are actually a part of that party, the everyday person that is, you know, that extreme white right wing. That's just way too much. Like, oh my God, I hate liberals. I hate Democrats and all that. That's kind of what pushes me away from that.
The rise in nonpartisan voters is partly because in 2020, Nevada decided to automatically register new voters who do any sort of business at the DMV, like getting a driver's license, as nonpartisan. They can manually register for a political party later. But Sandra Cosgrove, a historian at the College of Southern Nevada, says that's only part of the picture.
There's probably a lot of voters that just didn't feel like re-registering, but there is a large number of very young voters who are registered nonpartisan who feel really disengaged and alienated from the political parties.
The jury's still out over which kind of nonpartisan outnumbers the other, and that makes Nevada one of the most unpredictable swing states. There are other reasons why the state is a curveball. It's using an all-male voting system for the first time. There's a ballot measure that would enshrine abortion rights, which Democrats hope will turn out voters. And Nevada, which used to vote reliably for Democrats, toppled its sitting Democratic governor in the 2022 midterms. That's where nonpartisan voters come in.
They're going to play a major role, which is why we've, you know, built in an on-the-ground team.
That's Ty Sims, communications director for the Nevada Democrats. They've put nearly half of their offices in rural communities in order to court voters they don't always reach.
Most of these people we see as Democrats maybe just being registered as those nonpartisans or as those independents.
But Republican pollster Bob Ward, who conducts polling on Nevada for AARP, has a different view on these unaffiliated voters.
They are likely to be either disillusioned Republicans or Trump fans. These are not large margins. I don't mean to say that all of these people are that way, but he has the advantage.
Haley Dobbins is the communications director for Arizona and Nevada for the Trump campaign.
They trust President Trump on issues like the economy, on issues like immigration, on tackling the housing affordability crisis. And so those are the things that we feel like really turn out a lot of voters this election.
But 54-year-old nonpartisan Vance Acevedo, who lives in Las Vegas, doesn't buy that argument.
He's had a concept of a plan for health care. Why didn't he implement it for 4 years? He had a concept of this immigration wall. Where is it? Mexico? Did they? No.
But what Acevedo has found most disturbing is Trump's rhetoric, including that he wants to have generals like the ones Hitler had.
And I think there would be less support for Trump if people actually thought maybe he was going to do what he's saying he's going to do.
So imagine Acevedo's surprise when his partner, a fellow nonpartisan, told him he already voted for Trump.
Which is a radical reversal of his prior positions.
Acevedo, an ex-Republican, voted for Trump in 2016, while his partner voted for Hillary Clinton. Then they both voted for Biden in 2020. This time around, the couple still respects each other's decision and even joke about their votes.
We have to cancel each other out, I guess.
But that's not stopping Acevedo from volunteering for Democrats. Jeng Yunhan, NPR News.
A fiercely independent filmmaker, best known for working with Andy Warhol, died this week. Paul Morrissey was 86 years old. NPR's Netta Ulaby has this remembrance.
Andy Warhol was not a super famous artist when he met a skinny, intense film nerd in 1965. Paul Morrissey lived in an underground movie theater he ran in the East Village. He became Warhol's business manager and briefly managed the band The Velvet Underground, even though he hated rock and roll. One of his first films with Warhol just showed the group rehearsing. Before meeting Morrissey, Warhol made movies, but they were static, like a famous film that's just a single 8-hour-long shot of the Empire State Building. Morrissey added cuts, characters, life.
Hey, you.
Like the movie Chelsea Girls, their first art house hit from 1966. It's an improvised, 3-hour-long peek into the bohemian squalor of New York's Hotel Chelsea.
Hey, you, come in here.
What do you want?
Your heart.
My heart. I haven't got a heart.
Yes, you do.
The movie is not always easy to watch. Some of the actors are tripping and naked. There's S&M, violence, and a vaporous line between what's real and what's faked. Andy Warhol and Paul Morrissey made more than a dozen avant-garde movies over a decade. Warhol paid, Morrissey directed. They were extremely low-budget and provocative.
Go ahead, take your clothes off, man. Hurry up.
Like the one from 1968 called Flesh, about a hunky bisexual male hustler. In another scene, his girlfriend asks him, while in bed, for $200.
For what?
For my girlfriend's abortion.
$200?
Yeah.
Why do I have to give you $200 for your girlfriend's abortion?
Because you have the money and I don't.
The director was raised Roman Catholic, like Warhol. But Morrissey identified throughout his life as a deeply conservative Christian. A contrarian, he avoided drugs and sex even in the decadent swirl of Warhol's milieu. His movie's sex scenes were controversial, but not sexy. His actors are often wasted or uncomfortable, the opposite of the Hollywood sex scenes Morrissey despised.
It's just the stupidest thing in the world. People huff and puff and heavy breathe and go into clinches and roll around in mattresses with the clothes off. It's ridiculous.
Morrissey liked to insist he was pro-censorship, even though his movies were often banned. And he often cast transgender women in female roles because he genuinely liked their performances. He told Terry Gross in a 1988 interview on WHYY's Fresh Air that he hated professional actors, who he found pretentious.
And they're artificial, they're mannered, they're phony, and they're boring.
How did you cast people for your early movies?
If they were not boring.
Paul Morrissey's films, directed under Andy Warhol's imprimatur, are curios from the era. They include two poorly reviewed horror movies made in Italy.
Andy Warhol's Frankenstein is here.
After they split in the mid-1970s, Paul Morrissey told anyone who asked, including NPR in the year 2000, that Warhol took too much credit for their cinematic collaborations.
The misconception basically is that Andy was some sort of artist with a creative driving energy or something. He was the opposite of that. He was extremely limited.
On his own, Morrissey directed a few movies that made little impact and are hard to find, including one from 1982, starring a then-unknown Kevin Bacon as a grimy Times Square hustler complaining about bodega owners.
They shoot up the prices. They take over the square. They screw the numbers people, the peddlers, the loose joints, the hookers. They charge us up the pee hole.
Morrissey said his movies worked because they were funny. When asked if he felt they would hold up, Paul Morrissey said yes. He said they left a record of a specific time and place.
The way people thought and the way they didn't give a damn and the way they thought they could do whatever they wanted and get away with it. And all the time they're doing that, they're making their lives more miserable as they go along. I don't think that's a story that dates so much. So I rather enjoy them.
Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered. At a time when it seems like political rhetoric could not get more outrageous, it might be easy to see world leaders in the worst possible light. But NPR TV critic Eric Deggan says the Netflix show The Diplomat offers a different vision of politics.
The second season of The Diplomat kicks off with a bang, quite literally.
Can you take a deep breath for me?
Aftermath of a car bomb.
Hang on. I'm so sorry. Three Americans were just blown up. I have to call the Secretary of State, the Op Center, and the White House. You're not taking my phone.
That's Kerry Russell playing no-nonsense diplomat Kate Wyler. In the show's first season, Kate was plucked from a position in the Middle East and made ambassador to Great Britain, with hopes she might eventually take over the vice president's job. But the first season ended on a cliffhanger, as Kate's husband Hal, who is a former ambassador, and two other staffers were caught in a car bomb blast while meeting with a British official. They hoped to get more information about a suspicious attack on a British warship. As the second season begins, British Prime Minister Nicol Trowbridge, expertly played as a blustery, bullying egomaniac by Rory Kinnear, is still convinced Russians are behind both attacks, though his staff isn't quite so sure.
They've attacked us at sea and at home.
Two attacks would be tantamount to a declaration of war. Even Russia's unlikely to be that reckless.
Oh, of course they would. They have no red lines. They escalate in order to de-escalate. Philippa.
I would prefer a moment in private.
As would I. We're both disappointed. Pull up your trousers and speak.
This is where The Diplomat truly shines, balancing deliciously between political intrigue and emotional drama.
Somebody's going to get fired for this.
That's Ali An, who plays savvy, effective CIA chief of station Idra Park. She tells Kate that they may have to investigate the British prime minister, which could be a problem if it becomes public. Kate is willing to put her job on the line.
I'm okay with me.
You shouldn't be. You're a public representative of the United States. I get fired, it's a secret. You get fired, we look like the vampires everybody says we are.
But it's not until West Wing alum Allison Janney arrives as current Vice President Grace Penn that the show's drama really kicks in. Penn is a brilliant manipulator who may have to resign the VP job due to her husband's financial scandal. And moments after meeting Kate, Penn isn't so sure this woman can succeed her, distracted by an item holding up Kate's pants.
Is that a paperclip?
Oh, yes, I had a zipper issue.
When you're a second-tier diplomat in a third-world war zone, that may read as scrappy. If you're representing the interests of 300 million Americans whose health care is failing, whose planet is burning, whose future might get a little bit better or a little bit worse based on what you do in the course of a day, it's best to look like the care of your trousers wasn't more than you could manage.
Okay, that did sound a little West Wing-ish. Several storylines in The Diplomat revolve around smart women, including Penn, who deftly guide powerful men into making better decisions than they could manage on their own. It's also a world where politics plays out like a protracted game of 3D chess, and some government staffers still earnestly work to make the world a better place. Given our real-world political discourse, which seems more bitter and outrageous every day, watching a fictional world where many of the people who run things are smart and focused feels like a wonderful change of pace. I'm Eric Deggans.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
At Morning Edition from NPR News, we bring you the latest on everything from the presidential race to what interest rates are doing. But we also share stories that take us into other people's lives.
You actually played your horn while they were inside your skull.
Absolutely. Doesn't everybody?
Listen for the unexpected with the news weekdays on Morning Edition.
You will hear Morning Edition Monday through Friday, 5 to 9 a.m. on your KPR stations. Jay Schaefer is your local host. From the University of Kansas, it's Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 FM in Lawrence, 96.1 FM in Lawrence. Lots of other frequencies, too. You don't have to remember them because we have listed them for you online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from the Topeka Zoo, presenting Zoo Lights and the chance to host a private party or special event in a secluded igloo at the zoo. Details and reservations at topekazoo.org.
Stay with us. We still have a bit more All Things Considered yet to come. At 7 o'clock on your KPR One stations, it's Classics Live. We will be broadcasting the big Halloween concert that wrapped up our live day performances. That will be followed by more Destiny. She has some Halloween-ish music for you. And, of course, it's Tango Thursday. If you're joining us on KPR2, stick around for KPR Presents.
Got an old car taking up space in your garage? KPR's vehicle donation program accepts all cars, and donating is easy. We rely on your donations to help fund the programming you count on every day. Donate your car online at kansaspublicradio.org.
52 degrees in Lawrence, 55 in Topeka. It's 10 minutes before 7.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This election, the Republican Party plans to have tens of thousands of poll watchers in key battleground states. They say it's to help maintain the integrity of the election. Democrats plan to have election observers as well, but some people worry that the large number of poll watchers could intimidate or confuse some voters and potentially disrupt the vote. Challenging voters at the polls has been a partisan strategy used for decades. Rund Abdel-Fattah and Ramtin Arablouei from NPR's history podcast Throughline bring us the story of how a future Supreme Court justice helped launch a voter challenge program in Phoenix, Arizona, that soon went national.
Before he was nominated for the U.S. Supreme Court, William Rehnquist moved to Arizona to start practicing law. It was the late 1950s.
He's already coming to Phoenix with his conservative philosophy fully baked.
This is John A. Jenkins. He wrote a book called The Partisan, The Life of William Rehnquist.
He is deeply ideological.
William Rehnquist grew up in an all-white suburb of Milwaukee. He enlisted in the Army during World War II and served until the war ended. Then he came back, got his law degree from Stanford, where he graduated first in his class, and clerked for a Supreme Court justice.
So he just had a supreme self-confidence.
Like many other cities across the country at that time, Phoenix was reckoning with Jim Crow laws and an emerging civil rights movement. and Rehnquist was part of a new conservative voice that pushed back. When the Phoenix City Council passed an anti-discrimination ordinance, he wrote a letter to the editor and spoke at the meeting.
He got noticed, and he was effective.
Rehnquist was encouraged to get involved with politics, and that meant extra scrutiny of voters in precincts that leaned Democrat. Republicans believed that many of them were voting illegally.
Here's a quote from an article in the Arizona Republic.
We in the Republican Party think that it is un-American for persons to attempt to vote in violation of the law. We are surprised that your party does not desire to manifest the same interest in correcting illegal voting procedures.
Republicans said some people used vacant lots to register their addresses, or they hadn't lived in Arizona long enough to vote. They would also send mailers to Democratic precincts. If the mail got kicked back, they would challenge those potential voters at the polls.
Which brings us to November 6, 1962, Election Day. Voters lined up at an elementary school named after civil rights leader Mary McLeod Bethune. The precinct was predominantly Hispanic and Black. Later, witnesses would allege Rehnquist was there too.
The allegation was that he was showing up himself at polling places and challenging voters.
Under Arizona law, the different political parties were allowed to send delegates to the polls to challenge voters who they suspected were voting illegally. But election officials were the sole judges of a voter's qualification. So the question was, were Arizona Republicans going too far to challenge voters?
Together we will win.
What was happening in Phoenix, Arizona, was a field test for something much bigger, an operation that would be launched 2 years later during a presidential election.
And you and I are going to fight for the goodness of our land. Thank you.
In 1964, Barry Goldwater ran for president against Lyndon Baines Johnson. He and Rehnquist were both part of the so-called Arizona Mafia, a small Republican political powerhouse.
The momentum was in the Democrats' favor heading into the election, but the National Republican Party had a plan.
You may have heard of something called Operation Eagle Eye.
This is a campaign ad that Democrats released before the 1964 election.
Well, a better name for it would be Operation Evil Eye.
Republicans had already claimed that the 1960 election, 4 years earlier, was stolen. Operation Eagle Eye was the response. It was the same blueprint Rehnquist and his Republican colleagues were accused of using in Phoenix. So on the day of the 1964 presidential election, the New York Times reported Republican officials saying 100,000 trained Republican workers were in 35 key cities across the country. Operation Eagle Eye was underway.
Voters by the hundreds, perplexed and downright scared, were snarled yesterday in partisan poll watching, Miami Herald. Mexicans and Negroes complained to elections officials that they had received anonymous phone calls warning them of challenges at the polls. The New York Times.
I hope you will not be one of its victims.
Just to be clear, Operation Eagle Eye did not deliver Goldwater to the presidency.
Goldwater loses, big time.
And the story about Rehnquist challenging voters in Phoenix that went national with Operation Eagle Eye has become like many stories about mass voter challenges across the country.
Hosts Rund Abdel-Fattah and Ramtin Arablouei. You can hear the whole episode on NPR's Throughline podcast.
This story from Throughline comes from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
for the new champions of Major League Baseball. That would be the Los Angeles Dodgers. The hero of the World Series was first baseman Freddie Freeman. His four home runs capped off a year he says was the most challenging of his life. NPR's Becky Sullivan reports.
Freddie Freeman is the first to admit he can be an emotional guy, but nothing compared to the scare he had this summer with his three-year-old son, Maximus.
So seeing one of your kids on a ventilator, fighting, it was hard.
One day in July, Max woke up with a limp. By that night, he couldn't walk. It was a rare condition called Guillain-Barré syndrome. Freeman recounted rushing from stadium to emergency room. He missed 8 games and returned only when his son had turned the corner.
He's doing okay. He's on his way to being better.
Fast forward to October in the World Series against the New York Yankees.
Freeman hits the ball to right field. She is gone!
With the bases loaded in the bottom of the 10th, Freeman hit a home run to win Game 1. It was the first ever walk-off Grand Slam in the history of the World Series.
Those are the kind of things when you're 5 years old with your two older brothers and you're playing football in the backyard, and those are the scenarios you kind of dream about. That's as good as it gets right there.
Freeman homered in the next game, too. And in Game 3 and Game 4, that historic streak ended with last night's Game 5, but Freeman still had a crucial two-run single, and soon enough, he was spraying champagne in the locker room after the Dodgers had won it all. Before this, Freeman's resume was already enough for a spot in the Hall of Fame. Now he has a second ring to his name and that World Series MVP trophy, but none of it compares, he said after the game, to seeing his son get better. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
Go Dodgers! This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures, presenting the new movie Here, reuniting the director, writer, and stars of Forrest Gump, a tale of love, loss, laughter, and life. Here is now playing only in theaters. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals with a track record of excellence. More information on this year's MacArthur Fellows is at macfound.org. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate. At progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
A 16-year break, the band The Cure has come back with music that even they describe as doom and gloom. Good timing on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Join us tomorrow morning beginning at 5 o'clock on your KPR stations for Morning Edition. Jay Schaefer is your local host. We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Listen on the web at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speaker to play Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from KU School of Music, inviting KU alumni to return to the 100th Annual Vespers Choir, singing alongside fellow alumni while commemorating a century of Vespers tradition on December 8th. Details at music.ku.edu.
Coming up, Classics Live. We will hear that closing performance from KPR's Live Day, a Halloween-themed concert with Destiny. Then she, Destiny, will have more music for you here on KPR. Saturday on 105 Live, it's a live session at the Bottleneck in Lawrence with musical connections to Salina, Lindsborg, and Lawrence. The Draper Family Band features three generations of musician and a father-son duo of Kansas Music Hall of Fame's Paul Draper and Brandon Draper. Nick Carswell is your host. 105 Live. That is Saturday at 5 p.m. on KPR One stations. Classics Live is next at 7:01.
Welcome to Classics Live. I'm Cordelia Brown with Destiny and friends for a very special Halloween show. We're in the pavilion of the Lead Center of Kansas about to hear some great Halloween stories and some spooky music provided by Kansas Public Radio's own classical evening host, Destiny Ann Mermegan. Stay tuned for a bit of the Bach Toccata and Fugue in D minor, courtesy of pianist Karen Savage. Percussionist John Curry will provide spine-tingling musical effects. And Destiny's violin student, Evelyn Holmes, will share her own flourish from Paganini's Witch's Dance. Here's KPR's program director, Daryl Brogdon, to welcome them on stage now, here at the Pavilion of the Lead Center.
And now to close out Live Day 2023 on Kansas Public Radio, please welcome Destiny Ann Mermegan and friends.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to a very spooky evening classical. I am your host, Destiny, but tonight I am a different host. I am your narrator of a very terrifying story of the cast of characters of Halloween. Does a tragic fate await them at the hands of a very spooky ghost? Let's find out. We start with the witches and the pumpkins. And now the giggling goblins come out to play as they frantically prepare the way for the ghostly ghouls to appear. The ghosts have arrived. Spooky in their character and magical in their powers, they attempt to summon a very special ghost from his grave. The bell doth toll as the end of the night nears. Who is this special ghost who has risen from his grave?
it's Johann Sebastian Bach. He's risen from the grave to send all of the cast of characters of Halloween back to theirs. Bach is here, and our characters of Halloween have met their fate, death. But why? Well, they stole all of Bach's Halloween candy. And so, in a murderous rampage due to low blood sugar, he murdered them all! And now we have their funeral. But even in a dreary funeral, like the weather outside this evening, there are moments of peace and sweetness.
Thank you.
For historical purposes, Bach was not actually a murderer. He was a very kind and spiritual man, and so in that thought, we have decided to conclude this Halloween suite with a lullaby of the spirits to woo them off into a peaceful dreamland, probably just like Bach would have wanted. Thank you so much, everybody. I would say let's give a big round of applause to Karen, our magnificent pianist, for her rendition of Bach's Toccata and Fugue. Well, now this is my normal voice, so... I tried to have my scary voice at the beginning. Thank you so much, all of you, for being here and braving the rain and joining us for this Halloween-themed evening. If you notice, we have an amazing array of toys over there and a fantastic musician.